Hi-de ho, everybody, and welcome to the May 6th edition of Dead Pit Radio. I'm Uncle Bill.
And I'm the Creepy Kentuckian.
I'm Jessica.
And this is the series of shows that you've all been waiting on. This is the one that made us famous.
Yeah, the legendary May of the Dead shows.
That's right. And a lot of people know this show, not only for the interviews that we've had. We've had almost all of the people you can imagine from the different Dead series of films, Romero series of films on this show over the years, but also for the intro to the show, which we're not going to do at any point in the show. We promise we will not do
that. I did make that promise.
Yeah. So
to no one.
Yeah. So that, we promise we'll not do that because a lot of people seem to be aggravated with that, and that's not our goal.
Yeah, our goal is to please people.
We're here to please you and entertain you, of course, and take all your suggestions into consideration.
But week one of May of the Dead is upon us, and the interview this week is someone that we've always wanted to get. I don't know of too many people that have had him on for an interview. And it's Roy Frumkes from the Document of the Dead documentary.
Right, and he also, of course, wrote Street Trash and the Substitute series of films, and we're going to be talking to him about all that stuff. The thing that I like about this interview so much is how much information that this guy knows about the inner workings of these different movies, because a lot of times we have people on here, and it just seems like that they weren't even paying attention while the film was going on, or they just don't have anything good to say about anything that happened in the film, and this guy is definitely the exception to that.
Yeah, and this is a rather long interview as well. It's like over an hour long. So I don't know. I mean, should we, because next week is Friday the 13th, but maybe since it is May of the Dead, we should break it up a little bit because it's a long-ass interview. I mean, we're going to have a packed-ass show this week anyway, so maybe we should play the majority of the interview this week and a little, you know, the closing chapter next week.
Yeah, I say we just play the whole friggin' interview this week.
It's like an hour and 15 minutes.
Because the thing is, like, you're right, next week's Friday 13th, and you know we're going to be trying to find somebody for Friday 13th, and then after that, I think we've got at least one other person that I'm hoping will be a two-part interview. I'm hoping we'll be able to do it, but I'm also hoping that it'll be a two-part interview.
Holla. So, yeah, I mean, we'll play the majority of it, like I said, and this will be a long-ass show, I guess.
So get ready for that.
Yeah, Roy Frumkes.
Also, though, of course, we've got Blu-ray reviews. Don't really have any DVD-related reviews this time.
We wipe our anuses with DVDs now, just so you know.
And we watched this one last night. I think you'd seen it a while back, though. It's a Clint Eastwood flick with Matt Damon.
Yeah.
And Cecilia de France from High Tension. It's Hereafter.
I don't know what it is. He's worked with Matt Damon the last couple of movies. He did a movie called Invictus with Matt Damon like a couple of years ago.
Morgan Freeman.
Yeah. And now this one, which is, you would think it would be like a horror movie or something, but I don't know. It's kind of weird.
Every time I think of Matt Damon, I think about that in, what was it, Team America? Matt Damon.
I like that one where Sarah Silverman did that song where she's, fuck Matt Damon or something. I'm fucking Matt Damon.
Yeah, I don't really care for Sarah Silverman.
I fucking hate Matt Damon, though, just so everybody knows
Sarah
that.
Silverman.
I don't think she's funny. I don't know. She's one of those people that, like, the hoity-toity mainstream like, but I don't think she's funny.
So I'm hoity-toity mainstream?
No, I'm talking about, like, people on, like, the comedians on TV that have their own shows like her for some reason. I don't think she's funny. I just don't. She's like Carlos Mencia.
God, no, there's nobody as bad as Carlos Mencia.
She's not funny, but she is.
I don't think she's funny. I don't think, who's the old redhead? I don't think she's funny either.
Old redhead?
What the hell's her name?
Joy Behar?
She is old redhead.
What is her name? She was on, she did the New Year's thing.
Are you talking about Kathy Griffin?
Yeah, I can't stand her.
Oh, yeah, she's kind of, I don't know, I kind of like her, some of the stuff.
She's not funny.
like he just like goes by that. Yeah.
She's not. There's a lot of comedians I don't like, though. They all suck nowadays.
Yeah, you really don't even like comedy.
Can't they go back to fucking good old days, Bill Cosby and Richard Pryor and even like fucking Chris Rock? He was fucking funny.
No, they can't do that anymore.
Well, I suck.
But anyway, we've got a long ass show anyway, so we probably should just go ahead and get into the news. Wait, we've got more.
We got more news, buddy. Yeah. Dude, you gonna piss Don May Jr. off?
I don't want to do that. Shit.
I guess it's their second or third Blu-ray release now. It is The Dorm That Dripped Blood, and it's the first time it's ever been released fully uncut. It does have some great gory death scenes in it, and they are back in HD and DVD combo pack for the first time ever. Aren't you excited?
Bow down to it. So those are our Blu-ray reviews. So now that we got that out of the way, we get into the news portion of the show.
We have the mailbag later on, too. Big, deep one.
Very deep.
It's Ooh. Cavernous.
It is. It's ooey and gooey.
Yeah. Stop talking bad about my mailbag being ooey and gooey and cavernous.
It's like, the mailbag this week is like the girls that went into the caves in The Descent. They don't know, like, oh, there's a bunch of little creatures running around in it.
It's just like that. Yeah.
Just like that.
So let's get into the damn news. Fuck, let's go. Wow.
And this is should come to no as no surprise to anybody, really, is the Scream, I guess it's quadrilogy at this point. The idea for a second trilogy is apparently dashed after Scream 4 didn't do that well at the box office. It didn't do as well as a lot of people thought it would. Very underwhelming. And actually, it turns out that Insidious will probably be not only the highest grossing horror film, but the highest as far as margin of profit film that was been made in the last year, because it cost $1.5 million to make, and it's ended up going to gross like $100 million, which that should tell some people something.
Also guarantees a sequel, I'm guessing, at some point.
I hope not, though.
Yeah, that movie...
It doesn't need a sequel.
That movie would
it's
be
fine.
A horrible movie to make
it.
A sequel
they
of.
They need to leave it alone.
The
it
thing is, though,
it
lends the end especially lends itself to a sequel, though.
Yeah.
So, but I like it when movies do that and they don't make sequels because it makes you appreciate that movie a
the
little
thing
bit
is,
more.
Though, if history tells us anything, it says there's going to be a sequel to it, but we'll have to wait and see.
Well, history sucks. So the Dimension Films people say the Scream franchise will likely end here, at least for the moment. It says it's going to stop here and probably be on a future direct-to-DVD franchise, a la American Pie. With a projected budget of around $40 million, Scream 4 opened with $18.7 million, almost half that of its two immediate predecessors. And its second weekend wasn't much help with, it dropped 62.4%. It said it's not likely to score anywhere near the $160 to $170 million global haul that each of the Scream 2 and Scream 3 series achieved.
Yeah. Which, you know, I mean, the thing is, it's a big risk to come back 11 years later after the last sequel and expect the same numbers that the movie did, because it's... The thing is, when you go to a theater, look around you, see who the audience is. It's younger people, you know, teenagers. And if they don't remember the original Scream trilogy, they're not going to fucking go see it. I mean, when we were in there were a lot of young people in there still, but there wasn't enough of them that remembered it or were fans of the original trilogy to give a shit.
They really didn't do anything new with the movie either. Like, I thought the coming back after 11 years, they would try to reinvent the whole franchise, and it was just basically like a continuation. There wasn't anything new about it.
Well, I mean, I thought if anything, we would see the original characters from the first trilogy die off.
Yeah.
And
something that would startle people.
But they didn't really do,
yeah,
I mean.
They didn't do it because I remember in the second one, they killed Randy. They killed that one boy
right.
in the second one.
Randy Watson.
And our, what was his real name?
Jamie
Kennedy.
Which, that effectively killed his career, too, I think. After any of that.
I don't know, man. He's kicking it old school.
Oh, God, huh?
I actually liked that movie.
I liked it, too.
Never seen it.
It's
anything
kinda,
else he's in, I don't
cute.
Like, though.
He had a TV show, too. That didn't do well.
If you're a fan of, like, the breakdancing movies, Kicking It Old School is actually fucking hilarious
because
it sort of pokes fun at all of them. Anyway, Terminator 5.
Oh,
I guess
God.
It would be 5 at this point. Deadline reported recently that the long-awaited comeback project for Arnold Schwarzenegger will be The Terminator Part 5. Arnold's agents are out shopping a package that involves Arnold teaming with Fast Five director Justin Lin to bring back the T-800 to the big screen. They don't have a script, they don't have a target date, and they don't even have a firm grasp on who owns the Terminator franchise, but they have Arnold willing to play the part again, so you know that's enough.
I don't know how I feel about that, really, because he's elderly.
Well,
I mean, seriously,
the thing
at this
is,
point,
if he can get himself back into physical shape to do the role,
roids.
What they're doing now is, and they did it with Jeff Bridges in the Tron Legacy movie, they can, like, digitally make him look younger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably what they'll do, if I'm guessing.
That's what they did in the last one.
Either that or they would involve a story that took the, I don't know, I guess the model that was taken from the T-800, the real-life guy aged years later, something like that, and that would be Arnold Rohl.
Mm.
Although that'd be tough, I don't know. How would you do it, Uncle Bill?
I would do it like they do a lot of the movies these days. I would have like a young protege Terminator or something that was going to take his place, that he's like just kind of walking around with, and let that person do all the action sequences and just let him look like a badass.
Yeah.
That's what I would do.
I think it's definitely, they can still do it. I mean, Arnold, is he, he's out of office now, isn't he?
He's going to be, isn't he?
Or he's going to be real soon.
Yeah.
So, I mean, of course, if he wants to get back into acting, hell, that's the movie.
Okay, he's
the governor of California.
They don't run out of times that they can do.
I guess he's quitting, or he's just going to resign.
I know that he had said that he's not going to run for re-election the next time.
I'm sure that's been a horrible fucking job for him. I don't even know why he took it to begin with, really.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, the Terminator franchise, if you're going to do another Terminator movie, you've got to fucking have it. I mean, you can't do it without him again, because it'd be like another Salvation, which, you know, the movie itself, had they tweaked a few things, it would have been a lot better than it was, but it was still awful.
Yeah, it was a disgrace to that franchise. And the third one wasn't really any better.
No.
I hated both those movies.
I think the ultimate Terminator, like if they were to do another Terminator, fucking get James Cameron's ass to do another one. Could you imagine the fucking hype that would have?
The problem is, though, if he's already committed to a project, he's going to need 20 years to complete it, so he's not going to be able to do anything else in between.
I think he's doing the Avatar sequel right now or something.
Yeah. So you know that'll take at least 15 years. He's a busy man.
We'll just have to wait and see. But that would be what I would do. I mean, because you know James Cameron could come up with an awesome enough idea to where it'd work.
Yeah. Okay, so this is a company that's really started to come on the radar for us in the last couple of months. I got some of their early releases, like Day of the Dead, and what was the other one I got a long time back? City of the Living Dead.
City of the Living Dead.
And they've just seemed to be churning out a lot more of these Blu-ray titles that aren't available anywhere else, and it's starting to get people in the horror genre excited. Anyway, that's Arrow Video over in the UK, and apparently
I'm excited.
One of their releases for July is The Funhouse, which is Toby Hooper's 1981 film about four friends trapped in a carnival attraction with a vicious human monster.
It's the movie, not the Pink song.
That's right.
You remember that song? I heard that. I was like, that's a fucking lyric.
Wait, what was it?
The Pink song.
What Pink song?
Funhouse was the name of it.
Like Pink the singer?
Yeah.
She's got a song called Funhouse?
Yeah.
What's it about?
Funhouse.
That movie, The Funhouse?
Yeah, it's about the movie. That'd be the best song ever if Pink wrote a fucking song about this movie.
Yeah. Hell. It was something like a lyric, guys. This used to be a funhouse, but now it's just full of evil clowns.
Yeah.
That was a lyric.
Huh. Like,
you're kidding me. God, she's hiring a cop and she wrote that.
So it's a Blu-ray. This is a Blu-ray, not the Pink song. And here are the special features on it, which is pretty amazing. They always go all out for this. Woo. You got an audio commentary by the makeup effects artist Craig Reardon and Final Destination creator Jeffrey Reddick.
Woo.
You got audio commentary by the producer Derek Power and Howard S. Berger from KMB.
That's a different Berger.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then you got audio commentary by Teenage Wasteland author Justin Kurzweil and author Caleb Waddle.
We met Caleb.
Caleb, he's from Scotland, I think.
He's from Wales, mate. Don't confuse him. Fuck.
Stuck in the Funhouse featurette with Toby Hooper. Carnage at the Carnival featurette with Toby Hooper. Miles of Mayhem acting in Toby's Funhouse with star Miles Chapin. a trilogy of Terror, the Makeup Madness of Greg Reardon, where he recalls all of his collaborations with Hooper. Masterclass of Horror with Mick Garris, reflecting on Toby Hooper's career. Live Q&A, never before seen behind the scenes photos, 4-panel reversible sleeve option, double sided artwork, and all kinds of other shit. Meryl Video.
That's mine.
Yeah.
I'm totally getting it.
I figured you would, because that movie really doesn't have a decent release anywhere.
Yeah, and it's not like it's ever getting released here in the fucking U.S. They haven't even released a decent Blu-ray or DVD of it.
No. No, it never will.
Yeah. But also, a little bit under there, I don't know if you saw that, Slaughter High is getting a special edition DVD release, unfortunately, from Arrow Video a week later on July 11th. Or a week earlier, I guess.
Yeah, if you might remember, Lionsgate released it in the, what was that, Back to the 80s or yeah, Flashback Edition
or something
like that.
A lot of people were complaining about that because it was a video. It was, and it's bullshit. They said that was the only available. No, that's not the only available.
No, it was a VHS transfer. It looked like hell.
Yeah, I mean, like it was the uncut version. They said it was the only available. To me, like if that's the fucking uncut version, don't release the uncut version. Release the best version you can on DVD. I know nobody wants to see a fucking video transfer on a DVD.
You could release that and that version on DVD.
Or just release it as an extra feature or something.
Yeah.
But this one, they haven't said exactly what the transfer will be like on this, but I'm guessing that it will be a better, it won't be the video thing. It has audio commentaries with Mark Ezra, who was the writer and co-director, moderated by Kurzweil, audio commentary by Carolyn Monroe, Caleb Waddle, and Alan Bryce, introduction by Mark Ezra, gestures and jolts interview with Ezra, Lambs to the Slaughter, the Scream Queen career of Carolyn Monroe. It'll also receive the reversible sleeve and original newly commissioned artwork by Graham Humphreys, double-sided fold-out poster, which is all, those are always really cool. Collector's booklet featuring brand new writing on the film by author Troy Howarth, and the retail on this is $15.99 in the UK. Arrow Video, I gotta say, I gotta really put them over because they're releasing a lot of stuff that in the U.S., like you can play it on all of your, like the Blu-rays, you can play them on all of your Blu-ray players, pretty much. I think you had a problem on one of the extras discs or something.
The PlayStation, you can't play some of their discs on PlayStation because it's got some sort of compatibility issue or something.
Who knows? But I've never had an issue with any of their discs on the players I've got, but, just stuff that probably never come out in the U.S., like I'm guessing.
Probably not. I just wish there was some place you could order this stuff that didn't involve having to order shit from England, looking like through some other.
The best place you can order it is the Amazon UK site.
Right.
Anywhere else is going to charge you like, you can order it on eBay and you pay like $20 more. For it.
There you go.
That makes me wish that that one site was back. What's the one that went out of business? They used to sell like rare import Blu-rays and DVDs.
Exploited the Cinema.
Yeah.
Hell, you pay more than that though. On that, that site was outrageous. That's why they went out of business.
I never bought anything from that.
It's $60.
So, yeah.
But anyway, we're going to take a break. We will get back. We've got some more news to get to. And of course, Roy Frumkus of Document of the Dead, Street Trash. We're going to have him on for an extensive one-hour interview here soon on Dead Pit. You know what, Uncle Bill?
Shut your fucking mouth right now.
No. I want to talk about Fast Custom Shirts.
Holy shit. Well, let's talk about it.
FastCustomShirts.com provides some of the best horror t-shirts I have ever fucking seen.
I don't think that you can really fully appreciate how awesome the t-shirts are over at FastCustomShirts.com. Until you go over to FastCustomShirts.com and look for yourself.
Yeah. The Hitman T-Shirt Joe. Mm-hmm. The highest quality of shirts that I've actually designed some of them, Uncle Bill. He actually lets the fans design some of the shirts for his site. Who else does that? Who else?
Nobody I know of. But when he's not busy playing with Carmen Officey, he's busy cranking out some of the most high quality fucking shirts that you're going to find this side of any other damn whore t-shirt maker.
Yeah. So check them out. FastCustomShirts.com. The best there is.
The best there was.
And the best there ever will be.
It's a boot respect.
Welcome back to Dead Pit.
Hi.
How you doing? We got to get in some more news here, Uncle Bill. Go on.
Image Entertainment and Lakeshore are coming together to re-release the Image Entertainment library on DVD, Blu-ray, and VOD, which is Video On Demand. This means that another edition of Hellraiser, Hellbound Hellraiser 2, Children of the Corn, Creepshow 2, and Return to Ha-Ra-Ha are all coming out. I'm guessing on Blu-ray again. I have no idea why, since I'm pretty sure Anchor Bay released Hellraiser. And
I think that, did they release Hellraiser 2 on Blu-ray too?
I don't know.
And Children of the Corn's out on Blu-ray already as well.
Yeah. I don't know about Creepshow 2. Is it even, like, out on Blu-ray?
Creepshow 2 and Return to Ha-Ra-Ha and maybe Hellraiser 2 aren't out. I don't know.
So, I guess that'll be awesome.
We'll just have to wait and see.
You know, Hellraiser 2 is one of those movies where I really genuinely like that movie more than I like the original. So, I would probably buy that on Blu-ray.
You might not have to buy it.
They going to send it to us from Image Entertainment.
You might. I know some people from Image. Huh?
The fledgling Intervision Picture Corporation ran into a major hitch after releasing just two films when in March, the owner and proprietor, Larry Gold Sr., died of a heart attack, Uncle Bill. Severin Films has made a deal with the estate of Mr. Gold to take over production and publicity of the films in the Intervision catalog. The first title they'll be releasing in this partnership is one of the films that they started in the 80s, shot on video horror boom, Sledgehammer.
Wanna be Sledgehammer. Sledgehammer.
It'll be released this coming Tuesday. It's actually one of those, I don't know if you recall, it's one of those videos, those VHSs that are like an holy grail for VHS collectors.
Yeah, this is the one I always remember that Rick of the Dead had. It was like, the, I guess, the rarest one that he had.
Yeah. The press release they shot out says, Intervision is proud to present the return of the first shot-on-tape slasher movie for the home video market. And there's a ton of movies that claim that. Who knows which is the first one. As well as one of the rarest genre films of all. The plot is just your regular, like, you know, a group of friends comes to a party at a backwoods house where a legacy of brutality awaits, but within the mainstream, or within the minimalist 80s, of food fights, feathered hair, and abusive slow motion, lurks a relentless synth score, bizarre sexual subtext, and a disturbing shape-shifting behemoth killer. The result is 85 minutes of fever dream depravity, loaded with brand new boneless features, baby, that'll put it all in a skull-shattering perspective. Former Playgirl centerfold, Ted Pryor, oh God, stars in this nightmare logic shocker from the writer David A. Pryor of Killer Workout, where the lines between the twisted horror and historic gore are pounded to a pulp. By Sledgehammer.
Oh, man.
The extras include audio commentary with director David A. Pryor, audio commentary with Bleeding Skull creators Joseph A. Zimba and Dan Budnick, baby. Hammer Time featurette with Destroy All Monsters author Zach Carlson and Sledgehammerland featurette with CineFamily programmers Hadrian Belove and Tom Fitzgerald, and an interview with David A. Pryor. So that'll be out this coming Tuesday, Uncle Bill. Are you looking forward to it?
I actually am, because I like movies like that on VHS that, like Love Butcher and stuff like that, that would never have any real hope of getting on the...
Yeah, Love Butcher ain't out yet either. Maybe,
DVD, but there's something about that era of those kind of films made that I just enjoy. It takes you back to that period, and they're silly and they're goofy and stuff, but they're pretty entertaining too.
There's actually a couple of the, I think the first two Intervision releases we got, we just never did review them.
Really? What the hell were they then? I have no idea. I didn't even know we had them.
The Sinister Eyes of Dr. Orloff is one of them.
Why didn't we review that?
I don't know if that sounds too good, but hopefully we can get this. I'd like to see it.
What about the sinister dick of Dr. Orloff?
You know what, though? Like, most of those movies, like, Lunch Meat is another one that people are like,
yeah.
Oh, well. When you fucking watch them, most of the time, I'm not saying Sledgehammer is, they're fucking horrible. Like, I'm like, why in the hell would somebody pay $150 for a VHS?
I think it's just the collectability factor of it, like the rarity of the discs and or the tapes, that people just go crazy about them. They make them out to be a lot better than they are. I don't know. So anyway, here's one that I'm, ever so often a film comes along, I really look forward to seeing it, and this is one of those films because I've always been a huge Rutger Hauer mark. Hobo with a Shotgun is the newest one that's gotten everybody's attention, and it's coming out from Magnolia Home Entertainment on July 5th for a single disc DVD and a two disc DVD and Blu-ray. This says the latter two are jam packed with special features. So
I guess they haven't announced yet. Django Unchained, Uncle Bill. Django. A recent photo surfaced of the cover page of a script, evidently to Quentin Tarantino's newest film, which will be a sequel to the spaghetti western classic from 1966, Django.
Django.
Have you ever seen Django?
Didn't we review that?
Yeah, we reviewed it. It was before Jess come along, though.
Oh, okay. It was on Blu-ray from Blue Underground, wasn't it?
She was still in hippie land, baby. She wasn't getting in any of the Blu-ray and DVD goodness of Dead Pit.
She was up there like, come on. I was wondering if you had some patchouli.
Oh, God.
She was up there clapping her hands. Hey, smoke some weed with some hippie hands.
Leave me alone.
We were enjoying Django.
I like this pair of Birkenstocks.
You're so mean.
I kid. She's really not that much of a hippie.
I have seen Jack Johnson.
She's a pretty big hippie, Uncle Bush. She wants Dead Pit bandanas made.
That would be
cool. Dead Pit cargo pants.
Cargo shorts.
So anyway, on to something else that I hope to God never happens. We'll have to wait and see. Leatherface 3D, Uncle Bill. We haven't talked about this in a little while. Finally, news is flowing for the latest entry in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre legacy. Kirsten Elms is the latest writer to tackle the script. Elms' credits include the thriller Banshee, and Steven Susco, Adam Marcus, and Deborah Sullivan are all participating in the script in the new Chainsaw flick, which is said to be directed by John Lusenhop. So, they have such a hard time coming up with a new script for Texas Chainsaw Movie.
Yeah, that's tough. I don't know what you do with that. There's actually a thread up on the message board right now that I encourage people to go and participate in about the big four franchises of films, meaning Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like, are they dead? Are they alive? What's going to happen with them and stuff like that? I think they probably will go through with more Texas Chainsaw movies because it's, for one thing, it's simple. Just like Friday the 13th, it's simple as hell to come up with a movie like that. But for another thing, like, it's so over-stylized and violent that kids and like teenagers and stuff, they just love that kind of shit. And characters like Hoyt, that's completely over the top, stupid, you know, Arlie Ermey kind of stuff. That's the kind of stuff that I think that's the perfect type of film for the audience that goes to movies today.
I think of all of the remakes, though, the one that pisses me off more than any has to be the original Texas Chainsaw, because it is the movie that sort of changed, because, like, out there today in the fucking, you know, in the public eye, that is Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's almost like the original one doesn't exist, because when you say Texas Chainsaw Massacre, 99 times out of 100, they're going to be, oh, think about that fucking piece of shit with the lunch lady, whatever her name was.
Oh, the tea lady?
Yeah
we saw, we saw Halloween.
I'm scary.
Oh, my God.
Last night, it was on MTV for some reason. Like, it was, you know, it said Halloween. We were like, we'll click over that. And it's fucking Rob Zombie's Halloween, of course, on MTV.
Yeah, there was the remake of Friday the 13th was on. And then the remake of Halloween was on. And then there was a remake of, what else there was a remake of? There was something else. There was another remake of something that was on. It was just bang, bang, bang. And everything was just horrible.
I think that Texas Chainsaw was one of those, though, like, even when those sequels came out, that it really hurt the original movie as far as, like, the mainstream remembering the original movie. I don't know why it is, but it just seemed like Texas Chainsaw, the original, was the most hard one to get a hold of to see when we were kids, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it completely missed the whole concept. I don't know if it was purposely or if they just didn't pay attention to the first movie, but like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original movie, was not bloody at all. Like,
I
it wasn't.
Jessica Biel's butt was pretty.
No, I'm talking about the original, not the 1974 one. That one was
about, like, how the remake, that was the only thing good about it.
Well, that was the only, really, that was the only good thing about, I can even think about that movie now. Because all they concentrated on was the violence and how, like, everybody looked like they're supposed to be in the 70s or something. You know, the stylized clothes.
Yeah,
and stuff.
The camera, like, as far as the way the film looked, too. Like, okay, the movie is set in the 70s. Every motherfucker that's in that movie don't look like somebody from the fucking 70s. They look like somebody that's on the cover of fucking American Eagle.
Yeah, they were, right?
Abercrombie and Fitch.
I'm sure half that cast was on the cover.
They don't have 70s hairstyles. They don't have clothing that people would wear in the 70s. It's a joke.
No, it's not. It's completely for real. Especially the part where
Here's the thing. She ain't going to admit this. Up until last year, she didn't know what the original Texas Chainsaw was. She just thought that one was the original.
No, I didn't.
I didn't think about that, but that's true, though. That woman does pull a fucking gun out of her vagina. The one that committed suicide at the beginning of the film.
I actually liked that part, though. When she
I did, too.
No, when she did that and how the camera went through her
that
head.
That was a good shot.
That's ooey and gooey.
It was kind of cool.
It was a good shot. It was a good scene, and then it went completely downhill from the rest of the movie.
What about Rachel Dratch's role in that?
She had a role in that?
Do you remember the fucking anorexic woman with the baby? She looked like Rachel Dratch with the fucking, they had the arms sticking out of her head and shit.
She had an arm sticking out of her head?
Rachel Dratch did.
You remember that skit?
Yeah.
I always said, I fucking like, bottom line, I don't like remakes, people know that, but I hate to death those Texas Chainsaw, especially the first one. I mean, I will fucking, somebody wants to come up to me and debate a goddamn movie with me at a convention. That's one that I'll never, ever give up on.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's all the news that we got. What's opening nationally in theaters?
Actually, Thor is opening this weekend. It's directed. I actually had high hopes for this until I found out it was directed by Kenneth Branagh. Whatever his name is.
Kenneth Branagh. Yeah. That Brog. Guy is, he's like.
How do you pronounce his name? I don't even know.
I think it's Branagh, something like
Kenneth
that.
Kenneth Branagh.
But he's mostly well known for movies that are incredibly British, like Howard's End and fucking Hamlet.
Incredibly boring, too.
So I don't see how he's going to do a superhero movie, but we'll see.
In this movie, though, the warrior Thor, played by Chris Hemsworth, is cast out of the fantastic realm of Asgard by his father, Odin, played by Anthony Hopkins, which is another reason it probably will suck, for his arrogance and sent to Earth to live among the humans. Falling in love with the scientist Jane Foster, played by Natalie Portman, teaches Thor his much-needed lessons and newly found strength that comes into play as a villain from his homeland sends dark forces to Earth.
Brilliant! So, I've got the DVD and Blu-ray releases for May the 10th here.
Yeah.
And most of these, I've already been informed we're going to get for contest giveaways too, so.
Give me them.
Holla back. You got Lord have mercy, Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers.
What'd you do?
I'm a fan of myself. I hit myself in the head.
Darkner. Okay. Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers, and Halloween H2O 20 Years Later, Miramax double feature on Blu-ray, Hellraiser Bloodline, Hellraiser Inferno double feature Blu-ray, Halloween 6 Blu-ray, the Sledgehammer DVD, the Hellraiser 4 Bloodline Blu-ray, the Children of the Corn 3 Urban Harvest Blu-ray, Blood Junkie DVD. Children of the Corn, 5 Fields of Terror, Children of the Corn 666, Isaac's Return on Blu-ray, Dahmer vs. Gacy, AC/DC Live at River Plate. I never even heard of that. That's coming out next week. I'll buy the shit out of it.
Blu-ray and DVD.
On Blu-ray. WWE WrestleMania 27 Collector's Edition DVD and Blu-ray.
I'm definitely getting that.
Yeah, because the only reason I want those is just for the Hall of Fame shit. I don't give a damn about any of the other stuff.
At some point, I'd like to get all the WWE Blu-rays, but fuckers are goddamn high.
Also, though, the From Dusk Till Dawn, From Dusk Till Dawn 2, Texas Blood Money, double feature on Blu-ray coming out May the 10th.
There's going to be life of Blu-ray death.
And we're going to get them all. What do you think about that?
I want the Dusk From Dawn Blu-ray.
Well, we're going to get it.
I hope they do them right. It's the only thing. Anyway.
But it's Echo Bridge. What do you want?
There's no question them doing it right, is there?
No. What do you want from them?
So, we're going to
be
back.
They're probably
going to
be about $6 anyway.
Everybody, get ready for a very first interview for me!
Of the Dead.
We're going to be talking to Roy Frumpkin, baby. So here he is, and we'll be back with the mailbag after this long, extended interview on DeadPit.com.
Now, growing up and in college and things like that, did you take an interest in film or writing first, or what was your background like?
Back then, I really think no one knew too much about careers in film. They assumed you had to direct or act. I mean, today what I really love is writing, but I wasn't quite aware that that was an option to survive doing that. And so I thought, I guess I was going to be directing, and I went to Tulane University.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not that far from you guys, right? And I majored in English and creative writing. I was the head of the film society there.
Mm-hmm.
I remember doing an evening of experimental films, and I selected them, amongst which were Fantasia, the dinosaur sequence from Rites of Spring from Fantasia, but also there was something by Kenneth Anger, which was, you know, pretty raunchy. And at the last minute, the school administration sent down a message that I could not show the Kenneth Anger film and one other, because there was going to be a mixed crowd. You know, people from off campus could come with their families and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent a friend up on stage, and there were supposed to be 8 films, and he got up on stage very solemnly, and everyone quieted down, and he says, "Scratch numbers 2 and 7. And then he walks off. And then I promptly locked myself in the projection booth and showed them anyway, with the powers that be pounding on the door to get in. Those were fun times. I was at Tulane from 1962 to 66. Interesting.
Wow.
Period.
Yeah, that's a great time to be in college, I'd say.
Oh, my God. And in the South? Wow.
Yeah.
I'm surprised I didn't get myself killed, because I brought a very northern sensibility with me, and a lot of people didn't like it. Are we, by the way, live on the air, or?
Oh, no. No. This will be a week from Friday. Should be up.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm still prepared to, you know, embarrass myself as if I were live.
Talk about, though, how Document of the Dead, how you got, happened that caused, you know, because at the time, George Romero had only really made one zombie movie, and, you know, this was before he was known as a zombie.
I had seen him at the Museum of Modern Art talking about it, he was very sweet, you know, but very, very clear about the fact that he wasn't going to stay in the horror genre, that this was just a one-time thing. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, you know, we'll see about that. And then I think prior to that, I'd been working on a film called The Projectionist, myself and a fellow named Harry Hurwitz, who was the director. And that was shot in 68, and it came out in 71. And it's on DVD, a little bit hard to find. It was Rodney Dangerfield's first film.
Hmm.
And we ran out of money, and we thought, well, let's do a quickie horror film, shoot it in a week, edit it in 2 weeks, get it out, you know, in a month, and use the money to finish The Projectionist. And we're walking along Times Square, the old Times Square, and we said, here's something playing, Night of the Living Dead. Let's go in here and see the kind of bullshit we're going to take. And we go in there, and we sit down. An hour and a half later, we come walking out blinking, saying, we can't take that. I mean, what the hell is this? It wasn't well known yet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it was so extraordinary. And to see it just like We only saw two films that year because we were so busy making films. The other one was we went to a screening before it opened of 2001. I mean, we really got battered, you know. Seeing Night of the Living Dead and being just shocked crazy, like, we can't do this. And if this is a B film on 42nd Street, we're really in trouble. And then saying, we like Kubrick. Let's take a break from the editing. And we go in and see this thing. And after the first Thus Spake Zarathustra with those planets lining up, we looked at each other and said, I think one of us said, what's going on? And the other one said, let's get out of here. It was too upsetting, you know, because much as we love film, to be away from film and then to see those two. Anyway, that was my introduction to George. And then a few years later, I was teaching at SUNY Purchase, which was State University of New York. And there were several campuses. This was in Purchase. It was the last one built. And I was teaching filmmaking, and I just got this incredible feeling of guilt, because at that time, and we're talking about the mid-70s, there was no entrance to filmmaking for young people, really. There was no independent film scene. You know, there was no cable TV, there was no internet, there was no DVDs, there was no VHS. It had just started. I mean, there was like nothing, no MTV. You know, there was just Hollywood with a couple of hundred filmmakers who were zealously guarding their territory. I mean, I was teaching something for which there were no job opportunities. And I went to the school and I proposed a series of teaching films on independent filmmaking, like, because there had been films out like The Making of Butch Cassidy or The Making of Star Wars, you know, but those were big multi-million dollar films. There was nothing a student would relate to, I mean, other than in a dream state, you know.
Yeah.
But I wanted to do a series of teaching films about how you make films by yourself. And then a few years later, I was teaching at the School of Visual Arts in New York. Now, that's a privately owned school, not a state school, you know, and it's not run by committee. And again, I sent a letter to the head of the school, Silas Rhodes, and I said, look, the school's name would be on this series of films. It would go to high schools all over the country. A week later, I got a letter from him with a check saying, it sounds like a good idea. Go ahead. Good luck.
Wow.
Amazing. So then I couldn't shoot it in New York, because New York, back in 78, was called a union state. New York and LA and California were union states. There was so much filmmaking going on there by the studios that they wouldn't allow non-union films to be shot. All the other states were called right-to-work states, where you could mix and match union, non-union stuff, but not New York. So I looked outside of New York, and down in North Carolina, a guy named Earl Owensby, a very nice guy, was shooting a remake of The Wolfman, and he said he'd be delighted to have us come down. But then up in Pittsburgh, George was starting on Dawn of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to know Richard Rubenstein, socially, his producer. So I called Richard and I said, look, I'd love to come up there with some students, you know, maybe one or two teachers, and shoot a film about the making of this. And he instantly saw the value of it, although, as I'm told, there had never been a making of film about an independent film. I went up with two carloads of people, school equipment, a couple of cameras, two camera people, a sound guy, you know, a producer, a still photographer. I mean, not just seven of us. And in the 3 months that Dawn of the Dead shot, there was no other crew there shooting a documentary. I mean, we were it. If you compare that, there was a German TV station that shot a little bit, you know, for German TV, but it was just like a section for their show. But an actual documentary crew, when I went on the set of Diary of the Dead a few years back, there were three other documentary crews there my day, and there were documentary crews there every day for the entire shoot. When I went to Dawn, it was just me. If I had stayed there 3 months, it would have just been me. And I didn't realize at the time, you know, I was just trying to do a teaching film. I didn't realize that I was on the set of the Gone with the Wind of the horror genre.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, you talk about, you know, luck, good luck, you know. I found George very relaxed there. Him and the guys were, you know, shooting at night, and during the day they were sleeping. And then we got there and it was like late in the afternoon. They were starting to set up in the mall. And they were all sitting around in one little part of the mall watching rushes. Mm-hmm. And I was confused to see that the rushes were in 16 millimeter, which is one quarter the size of 35. Now, what I later found out was that they were shooting the film in 35, but George and his partners had a studio where they did commercials, and they were shooting 16. So the lab would just reduce the rushes down to 16 so that he could cut them, and then it would be conformed and blown back up. And we all sat and watched for a while, and I saw that it was in color, mm-hmm. that it was very, like, op art. I mean, it was really bright, vivid, primary colors. And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell is going on? On the ride up, we all took turns, you know, the 7 hours it took to get to Pittsburgh. Richard had sent us the screenplay, and we all took turns in the cars reading the script. So we had a good idea of what it was about, but the script didn't suggest color and the spectacle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We really were surprised by what we found.
Now, I mean, being that you studied film and had taught some, yeah. What did you learn, like, from that experience, like, about film? Did you pick up anything from Romero?
Oh, it changed my whole career. I mean, they had a very specific style going on there, which is not an American style, which was the producer's role was to protect the director. In this country, the role between the producer and the director is adversarial, I'm sorry to say. And the producer can fire the director anytime they want. The producer literally is the largest shareholder in the film. The producer stays with the film long after the director's gone. But in Europe, it's much more of a symbiotic relationship, and the producer does everything. I was hired by Pierre Spangler to do a rewrite of a script for Alejandro Jodorowsky, and they flew me over to Amsterdam. This was in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And Spangler, who had produced the Superman films, I mean, all he was doing was walking around following Jodorowsky and saying, "Maestro, maestro, what can I do for you, maestro?" And Jodorowsky was, you know, he may have had a huge ego, but it was not that kind of ego. I took my Jodorowsky one day. We were looking for locations, and I said, "God, I'm hungry. Let's go to a pizza place." And we went in, and we're sitting there, and Spangler walks in and almost fainted because the maestro shouldn't be eating in a pizza spot. So, Dawn of the Dead had a very European sensibility. Rubenstein, you know, was being careful about the budget and all, but man, he was just protecting George, you know,
mm-hmm.
And I've always, ever since, in all the films I've produced since, that's what I do, protect the director. The other thing was, I studied it and I saw that this was a inconceivably low-budget film because they got the mall for free.
Mm.
The mall owners were investors in the film. And I saw, I mean, they shot for 3 months. When John Landis did the Blues Brothers and they were in a mall for 2 days, they spent like $1 million.
Oh, yeah.
So I said, oh, my God, I get it. So when I did Street Trash, I made sure, you know, that the investors own the collision yard and the junkyard, you know? And we just had free run of that place for more than 3 months, more like 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lot out of Dawn of the Dead, both in terms of how to produce it and both in terms of using what you can get for free, using a big location for free.
Right.
Now, a lot of people may know that you were actually a zombie on Dawn of the Dead. Now, how did that all come about? Because I believe you're only on the set for a couple of days, right?
That's true. And when I got there, which was even more baffling, was that they weren't shooting anything from the script. And this was like a 250-page script. And they were just off shooting some other stuff. The pie fight wasn't in there, you know, the bikers squirting the zombies. I'm saying, what is going on here? You know, I mean, there's zombies taking baths in the fountain in the mall. I couldn't figure it out. And George said, well, we've covered everything. We're ahead of schedule. You know, he was a very fast director, shot very fast. Didn't spend much time setting up. You know, got his shots and moved on. And Michael Gornick, his DP, was very attuned to that. So they were ahead of schedule. And they were improvising stuff, like Savini's character was developed on the set and was not part of the script. So I get there, And someone says to me, I suspect it was George, but it could have been Richard Rubenstein, seeing the promotional value, would I like to be a zombie? And I said, oh, my God, great idea, because The Projectionist and a few of the other earlier films I'd worked on were reflexive films. They were films that talked about filmmaking. And I thought this would be so much fun for the director to be a zombie in the film, about the film he was, you know. So I said, absolutely. So that night, Savini, they had a large crew of makeup artists. But Savini was taking the zombies that were being given close-ups and spending a few hours on each one. I had my second cameraman, James Callanan, do the time-lapse photography of me and the producer, Suki Raphael, getting the makeup put on. I didn't quite realize at the time, and this is something I look back at and I feel strange about, was that, I mean, Tom is like the Salvador Dali of the makeup genre, more so than Lon Chaney, more so than Dick Smith or Rick Baker. You know, because he's a showman. These other guys, I mean, Chaney was, I guess, a showman, but Rick Baker, Dick Smith, they're kind of behind the scenes. You don't get to see them that much. But Tom is visible. He plays a biker. He does stunts. He's very in your face. You know, he's all over the place. And so he was reminding me of Dolly. And he did my makeup, and it was like Dolly doing a painting on my face. And to then, within 20 minutes, have it obliterated by that pie made no earthly sense. I should have just gone home like that and come back in a week to get the pie. I should have lived with that makeup on, but it was not to be. So that's the evolution of that.
And
I guess one other interesting thing, which is that we didn't have enough money to go back up to Pittsburgh to shoot George editing, and I did want this first film in the series.
Mm-hmm.
And the series never continued, but I wanted the first film to cover all aspects of filmmaking, development, production, pre-production, post-production, securing distribution. I wanted the whole arc of independent filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't afford to go back up, so I got in touch with Michael Gornick, and I asked if he could just shoot one roll of 16mm film, 11 minutes, on George editing. He said, sure, I'd be glad to. And, you know, a week later, the negative arrives, and we bring it into the lab. And wouldn't you know it, I mean, that film was about 3 hours long, 2 hours and 50 minutes, its first fine cut. He could have been anywhere in the editing room, but he chose to cut the footage of me getting the pie just so that I would have one additional reflexive thing in my... Isn't that sweet? That's the kind of guy George is.
I really do think, though, and I don't know how you feel about this, that the thing that really sets him apart is his editing. Like in a lot of the films that he does, just because he spent so much time doing it for commercials and things like that before, that's the thing that really makes those movies for me about him, though.
Amazing editing in his first, you know, up until he relinquished control to an editor. I mean, because when you do that, you're still sitting there, you know, but you're not sitting there all day long. You're visiting, you know. I mean, when I was up the second time on Land of the Dead, I flew out. Some TV station, IFC, sorry to say that, some TV station, IFC funded a documentary, and they had me direct it, called Dream of the Dead. And we all went up to film him shooting Land of the Dead, and then they just sent me up alone to shoot him in post-production and get the usual walk-and-talk interview. And he was in the editing room, you know, very casually with a cup of coffee and talking, you know, through the mix and stuff. But the editor was also working, and they weren't with him the whole time, you know. He'd cut, and then they'd visit him, and, you know, he kind of knew. But in the old days, you know, pre that, George was editing it himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very influenced, I would think, by Orson Welles. You know, I mean, the cutting was so rapid, and the angles were so dramatic that it was. It was really stylistically him. Roman Polanski, and this was while he was exiled. And I called him one time in Paris, and he said, have you seen a film called The Stranger? And I said, yes. He says, is it by Orson Welles? And I said, yes. He says, I knew it. I tuned in late, but I could tell it was his style.
Mm-hmm.
The editing, the angles. I said, absolutely right. You could tell with George, too. Mm-hmm. More so in the old days, you know, than now. But you definitely could. I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah. Now, Document of the Dead, the second half of the film, which is, for some reason, is always the most memorable for me with the metronome and all that. You're setting up the scene there. That was like 10 years after the footage from Dawn of the Dead. What was the reason for the big gap there?
When I was finished with Document of the Dead, it was 66 minutes long and nobody wanted it. It was an unwieldy length, and VHS was in its infancy, and it was just it was very odd. I guess it wasn't in its infancy, but no one made me an offer that I liked. And so I just hung on to it, you know, I owned it. You know, the school put up money. I then had to raise another $20,000. The thing went way over budget, at least over my initial hopes of a budget. And, I saw no reason to release it for nothing. And it just became a rumor, you know, there was word circulating in the genre, community that, there was this film on the One of the Dead. Finally, one of my students, a guy named Len Anthony, 10 years after he graduated, calls me and says, I started a company called Off Hollywood, and I'd love to put out your movie, but I would fund you to do a follow-up. And I said, I said, okay. So I called George, and he was just starting Two Evil Eyes 10 years later, and it had zombies in it, different kind of zombies, but zombies nonetheless. So I said, you mind if I come up? He said, yeah, I mean, I don't think you can shoot on Dario's sequence, but you can certainly, I'm thrilled to have you shoot on mine. So again, I went up there, but this time we shot on video. I hired people that George knew and had worked with before. We had two cameras, and it was funny because the original Document of the Dead, which was 66 minutes shot on film, where you have to process it in a lab, do work prints, all that, cost $33,000. 24 minutes, the second part, on video, cost $50,000. That's how much the prices had gone up. So, but even going to a medium that was less than half the cost was still much more. And so I trimmed about 6 minutes out of the original document and added these 24 minutes on. So now it was 84 minutes. And I really loved doing that. Now, as you know, there is a third and final chapter. It's now called The Definitive Document of the Dead. And actually, when I get off with you guys, I'm going to watch the final cut with the final mix and make sure that it's okay, because I'm being flown over to Hamburg, Germany, on the 11th of May for the world premiere of it at a Congress of the Undead.
Oh.
And this final chapter. In order to do that, I cut another 10 minutes out of the original document. I cut about 5 minutes out of the second part, so that the film, just because the film needed more energy in order to support another half hour or 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. And this one covers Land, Diary, Survival, Savini's remake of Night.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got some real surprises. I mean, you guys are going to be so happy.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds amazing in and of itself. Yeah, if it's going to span that entire series.
Yeah, 33 years in production. And I'm done. I mean, I said to George, look, man, you can keep on making money. I am going to get in my hammock and just swing from this point on. He said, well, good luck, man. No, I got plenty more to do.
Now, I think the first time I had seen the original cut of Document of the Dead, it was on IFC. Or one of those channels like that.
Yes, that's right. I like
years ago, I think before the DVD release and all that.
Yeah.
What kind of original release did it have as far as, I think it was released on VHS, but it was kind of rare.
No, it really only was that the double-parted one. It was the first time it was on VHS. And it was, if it was on VHS in any other form, it was so rare that it was a bootleg.
Okay.
And I honestly never came across one. You know, I heard rumors, but I never spotted one myself. Of course, I've always heard that when I would go to chiller conventions and stuff like that, word would spread, like, Frumkus is here, and they'd hide all of the bootleg prints, which wouldn't have terribly upset me. I think bootleg is a form of, you know, it's a compliment of some kind. And I, you know, they don't really ruin the market, the indie market. They ruin the Star Wars market, but not the indie market. But in 89, I guess, this double, you know, the first two chapters came out from Off Hollywood. And we also did a gold box. We did, I think, 2,000, which George autographed everyone. And it was a special, like, for $90 or something. And it was, you know, a limited edition. So there were two different editions of that version that came out. But after that, it was just, you know, and I have to tell you something. The Synapse, the company that's releasing the definitive Document of the Dead, they, a few years ago, they went back to the original A&B 16mm negative of the original Document of the Dead, and they did a high-definition master, and it had been originally taken off of a 16 print. It always looked washed out, all the prints that have ever been released of it. Now it looks like Technicolor. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really, and their new release is going to have the original 66-minute uncut, and then the definitive Document of the Dead, the three-part one.
That's amazing. Yeah, Don May, the guy that runs that company, I mean, he's just outstanding when it comes to the transfers on those discs.
Oh my God, he just loves the medium. He just loves the films, and he just, I mean, he was so uncompromising, you know, for both the mastering of Street Trash and Document. He flew me out to L.A. and just sat with me in the room there for as long as I wanted, went over each shot until I was happy. I mean, really incredible. You know, I'm very lucky to be with that company. They've got five of my films. They're putting out another one in about 2 months called The Sweet Life.
Awesome. So, yeah, well, since you mentioned it, though, we haven't really gotten into this yet, but another one of, like, the, I guess, the better-known projects that you've done would have been Street Trash. So
yeah.
How did that originate? Like, how did the idea originate?
It was a student of mine at the School of Visual Arts, Jimmy Muro. He, very gregarious, nice kid, freshman, 18 years old, came in, you know, big handshake. Hi, Jimmy Muro. Hey, how you doing? And he published like a little, not published, he printed a little kind of really raggedy horror thing in his basement, that kind of thing, you know. And second year there, I had him again for screenwriting. First year I had him for production. And he did a 12 or 16-minute version of Street Trash in 16mm with Mike Lackey. I was in it, and it played in clubs, midnight clubs around New York, like after-hours clubs. And it got this following, got really good responses. And someone approached him, a guy named Terry Levine from Aquarius Films, said that he could raise another $50,000 if Jimmy would film another hour of it to attach to the 12 or 15 minutes he'd already done. Mm. And Jimmy came up to me and said, look, man, you got me for screenwriting. You know I can't write. Would you be willing to write the script for the feature? And, you know, and I said, well, yes, of course I would. I said, but, you know, an uncle of his had died and left him some money, and he started investing in a Steadicam apparatus. I said, Jimmy, I don't think you want to make a grungy-looking, you know, Poverty Row film. I think you'd actually like to make a real big, classy production, albeit horrific, you know, and politically incorrect and all, but something that really shows off the Steadicam and all your great stuff. And mm-hmm. He said, you're right. So I said, well, I'll write it, but I'll also raise the kind of money that would support that kind of production, and we're not going to use the first 15 minutes that you did in 16. Mm-hmm. He said, great, man, great. So I took a year off from school, from teaching, took a sabbatical, and it took that long time, I mean, practically, to raise the money, because the film, even in script form, was so, unrated, you know? There was no way I could get the money from 35 people or less, which is a limited partnership. I had to do a joint venture, which was selling shares. I had to sell 200 shares at $2,500 a piece to raise $500,000 to shoot the film and get it in the can. And it took a long time, but we launched on the following, you know, after a year, that summer we launched. I had written a script that was kind of inappropriate for an independent film. You know, all the other horror, art, gore films that were made around then, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, Evil Dead 2, Hellraiser, Reanimator, they were all confined to a few locations. They were very wisely written to be limited in their scope. so that they could be done cheaply in just a handful of weeks. We had something like 68 locations. We had over 150 actors. I mean, it was a very big, expansive film, and we shot for 12 and a half weeks, which is, I have never come across another indie film that shot that long.
Mm-hmm.
It was a folly, you know, but look what came out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly right.
Yeah.
Now, you had mentioned earlier, though, that the whole junk scrapyard sequence and all that stuff, you had made sure that that was already owned, or that you knew people that owned that?
Yeah, Jimmy Muro's father owned the collision yard. And he loved his son, you know, do anything for his son. And so he became an executive producer, and he gave us that yard. So, I mean, what we did is, I mean, inside the warehouse, there were all these car ports where they would disassemble cars, you know, it was a wrecking yard, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then sell parts. And we just took over those ports. We changed one into the makeup room, one into the prop room, one into the wardrobe room. One of them became our standing set. In case it rained, we built the liquor store basement where the Vipers found, and it stood there all summer. In case it rained and we had our crew, we could immediately shoot inside and not lose a day of shooting. So we literally monopolized that place. I know he lost a lot of business, you know, but he never complained. And we just shot there and shot there. You know? And then for the, you know, we had 2 weeks of night shooting. And there we were going all over the Queens and Brooklyn area, you know, finding locations and stuff. But yeah, that was what we did. It would have been inconceivable to do the film if we didn't get that. And even at that, the film cost about $900,000 eventually. Ended up being around $900,000.
I'd heard, I was actually looking this up, on the internet that Bryan Singer of, Usual Suspects and X-Men and, you know, other superhero
Superman
movies.
Returns,
yeah. He was actually like behind the scenes, like a grip or something on the movie. Is that true?
He was in charge of the penises. You know that scene with the penis talk?
Yeah, of course.
I don't know how it affected him in later life. I'm trying to look for it symbolically in all of his movies, you know, but yes, he was a production assistant, a PA, the lowest life form on any set. And he was coming down from somewhere in New Jersey. It was a long trip for him every day to get there. And then he'd have to drive home at night. And it was too much for him. And he started screwing up. And I had the unpleasant task of firing him. Doubly unpleasant now as I look back that I fired Brian.
Right.
What kind of a jerk was I? But he was crying. I mean, he was so upset that he had to leave. And I said, look, Brian, you have got what it takes. And you worked your head off. This is just too much for you. You'll be fine. You'll have a great career. And he was so upset, and he went away. Later on, he was rehired during post-production. He was working in the editing room doing stuff. But, yep, there he was. Real sweet guy, and we're still friends. I mean, I'm now trying to see if I can produce a remake of Fiend Without a Face, and Brian's got the script, you know, because he wants to do horror films, and we'll see if something goes on. But he's also, I also did a 2-hour documentary on the making of Street Trash called The Meltdown Memoirs, which is on one of the deluxe editions of the DVD.
Right.
And Brian's in there, you know, and he's up on the set of X-Men 2 and, reminiscing about working on the film.
You know, maybe you fired him. Maybe that set him on the path to become the uber director that he is today. I don't know.
You know, it's possible, but I got to tell you, I had him also as a student. He was a student at the School of Visual Arts, a young kid, 18. People were shooting with Super 8 film back then, and I'm talking to all of the kids in the class the first week and saying, so what are your ideas for a film? And they're saying, well, I'd like to shoot my dog and have him show how he's trained and he can bring the newspaper. Another kid's saying, yeah, I'm going to do one on my two sisters and, you know, how they fight over who uses the bathroom in the morning. And I say, okay, Brian, what about you? He says, well, I'm starting with a helicopter shot coming. And I'm saying, what? And everyone just turns and looks. I said, Brian, Super 8, calm down. He was serious. He had these grand visions, even then, you know, which were not within his ability to do back then, but you can see where it ended up.
Mm-hmm. What about the actual cast of the film, though, Street Trash? I mean, where did these people come from? Were they students? Did you have any aid in the casting process?
Right. I did use students on the crew. I had this idea that I would hire professionals and have them the head of each department. but then all the people working under them would be students. I thought this was a great way, going back to Document of the Dead, trying to create concepts that would get students jobs in the industry, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we had a crew of 55 people, and about 20 were professionals and about 35 were students. None of the actors, though, were students. And we cast them in the most unusual ways. You know, the way to do it on an indie film is to put an ad in the Backstage magazine, or, of course, nowadays you can put it up on the Internet, you know, Craigslist and stuff like that. But these parts were just not the kind of parts you'd find the normal way. So, for instance, for the Wynette, for Nicole Potter, great actress, we put up signs in anorexic clinics. You know, and for Vic Noto, you know, for Bill Chappell, you know, the cop, we were putting up signs in gyms, you know, and mm-hmm. playing bikers clubs and things. I mean, we were really going far out to find the people for those roles. And luckily, there's no roles in that film that were compromised. You know, I remember when Wes was doing the original Hills Have Eyes, and he wrote me that the casting process was just terribly disappointing. And that he never found anyone, with the exception of, you know, the fellow that played, who was it?
Pluto?
Mars. Yeah. He couldn't find anyone to be the father. And I said, how about William Smith? Can you find him? So, but it's a terrific film anyway. It's a classic, but he never cast it to his satisfaction except for one role. He even wanted the girl in a film he had done for me called Tales That'll Tear Your Heart Out. He wanted her to play the Ruby, the primitive girl, mm-hmm. and Peter Locke, his producer, said no. So he didn't even get that, you know, which was a part he knew would be good. But with Street Trash, we had as long as we wanted on that film. We just cast and cast and cast until we had the perfect people for every role.
I'm sure people are wondering, though, I mean, where did the Bronson character, like, how did you get him?
Well, you know, the funny thing about him and Bill Chappell was the cop and Vic Noto was Bronson. They were both what they were. Bronson was a Vietnam vet, disqualified Section 8.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Chappell was a super cop. His beat was 8th Avenue and Times Square, and he was, had been involved with things that far exceeded what he was called upon to do in Street Trash. I mean, they were the real thing. And when it came time for them to do their fight scene, they came up to me and said, look, these fake pipes and all this shit, can't we just hit each other? We'll enjoy it. I said, oh, my God. That's a terrible thing to ask the producer. I mean, for a couple of reasons. One, Bill was my friend, but also, you know, there's a lot of other actors, John Wayne, Kirk Douglas, people like that would have done their own stunts, but they're not allowed to because of the insurance. And what would happen to the production if they got hurt, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, some of the only people that did their own stunts, and they did one of the greatest fight scenes of all time, were Rod Taylor and William Smith. Have you seen Darker Than Amber?
No.
Check out the fight scene on IMDb, on wherever you can find it. You won't believe what that's like. And that's the two of them. They broke each other's noses. They broke ribs. I mean, it's unbelievable. The blood was real. And I know both of them. I know Rod Taylor and I know William Smith. And they were having fun. It was a, you know, it was like a laugh to fucking beat the shit out of each other.
Wow.
So, yeah. So Bill and Noto come up to me and said, look, we can tolerate this. And they beat each other black and blue. You know, I was just, and I just stood there. I had nightmares about it.
That is,
but
I mean,
but they loved it. They'd hug each other afterwards.
That's just awesome. I have to go back and watch that scene again now, just knowing that.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
As far as street trash goes, though, the cult status it's attained over the years, has that surprised you at all? And when did you first notice the fan base?
Well, I actually, when we did the film, we thought it would be pretty outrageous. And then Vestron Video, when they picked it up, they felt it had the ability to become another Rocky Horror Show. They booked it into midnight shows around the country, hoping that people would come, and in the same theaters that Rocky was at, hoping that people would come and would start repeating the lines and getting into it. But it didn't happen. It didn't take off the way they had hoped. And so I thought, well, okay. I mean, I still love it, and we're licensing it around the world, and it's doing great in places like Japan and France. But then as the years went by, it finally did pick up that cult following, you know, and it finally did have people in the theaters, particularly imitating Black Suit. You think, you know what you think? I think I know, you know, all that stuff.
Mm.
And they would have their favorite characters, and it's been terribly gratifying to me. I mean, for the 20th anniversary, I went out and did some of those horror shows, and I lured James Lorenz and Mike Lackey and Bill Chappell to join me at some of those, and they were all astonished, you know, that there were thousands of people coming up for autographs and all. It was really very, very gratifying.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't, I thought it had that potential. It didn't initially, and then it did.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that we didn't touch on, though, that I don't think it would be fair to leave alone with that film is the effects and stuff in the film. Like, there's some amazing, just amazing practical effects.
Yeah, people love that film today, partially because it was pre-CGI.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing in the film that had been enhanced, you know, and there were all those wonderful makeup ideas. Most of those ideas were written by me, including the colors, because I had this kind of completely demented thought that if everyone melted in color, we'd get an R rating. I don't know what I was thinking. That film would have had to been 10 minutes long to get an R rating.
Yeah, that's what I was like.
But still, melting in all those pretty colors turned out to be a great idea. Then the script and the storyboards, it was very carefully storyboarded, were all handed over to Jennifer Aspinall, who was our chief makeup artist, the head of the makeup department. And she designed all the makeups and hired two other gifted people, and then there were three people working under them. So it was the makeup department with six people, and they divvied up the scene so that, like, Jenny, for instance, built the animatronic head of Vic in the ending when he's decapitated.
Yeah.
She also did the head in the toilet melt, which later was on display at Lincoln Center. Dean Kartalis did the exploding wino, you know, the one that blows up.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Lackey did the liquor store meltdown. Scott Coulter, who went on to become a really top makeup guy, did Wizzy's melt, you know, against the Mae West thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like they all divvied up who got what. And we had a terrific art department, and the art department rebuilt those sets. Like, in other words, let's say the Paulie melt in the beginning down the toilet. It's a real building, derelict building. It's a real toilet. And then once he starts melting, the art department rebuilt that inside one of the car stalls in the warehouse. And the prop department built a toilet two times normal size, and they elevated the bathroom off, you know, several feet off the ground so the guy would melt through and go down. Because it would take 3 days to shoot each of those melts, and they couldn't control the lighting. So they would match the light from the exterior and then just have that same light for 3 days, and just we could keep shooting it and shooting it. If some of the glop came out by accident somewhere and it shouldn't have, we could do it again. We just kept doing it and doing it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's how all those were done. Yeah, it's great effects. And for me, I knew that's what would sell the film, but I challenged myself when I wrote the script. I said, wouldn't it be fun if there were no melts in Act Two? So I had two melts in Act One,
mm-hmm.
and then I had five melts in Act Three. And Jimmy said, well, what's going to keep them in Act Two? I said, well, I said, remember that scene you told me about? You'd like a, you know, some derelict to be pissing through a hole in the wall, and someone else just cuts it off, and you thought that was a funny gag. I turned the gag into something a little bigger. he read the pages, and he said, man, I don't know what you were smoking, but please send some over.
Well, I was actually going to ask about that. When you said you'd written most of the effects, and they're like, did you sit down and write, like, all that out, like how that would take place? I can just imagine that.
Yes, and actually, this is the one thing about Street Trash that people find mind-blowing. It was stronger in rough cut than it was in the final thing. We actually exercised a certain degree of taste and tact. And some of that was in the decock rock. Some of that was in the rape scene. And those are scenes that seem utterly unexpurgated. But in fact, in our rough cut, they were longer. They were both longer. And what we were doing was we would test the film. We had test screenings. And we would bring in, we wouldn't just bring in random people, you know, old elder, you know, the elderly off the street and stuff. We'd come. And in those scenes, in the early cuts, they'd have 10 people, they'd all leave. They would be so offended, they wouldn't stay. Jimmy and I and the editor sat down and we said, look, I mean, that's great, you know, but, and there was no DVD then with director's cuts, you know, there was no, so that we'd have that other cut. We said, I mean, we can't afford to lose everybody. That doesn't make any sense. So we started trimming some of the worst stuff. And when it hit the point where only 3 people were walking out at each screening, that's when we said, okay, we got it. There is a little bit of that stuff restored in the Meltdown Memoirs, but not much.
Now, you mentioned the definitive document of the dead.
Yeah.
It's finally finished completely. Now, as far as like, because you were around Romero in the early days, how do you think that he's changed as a filmmaker and just the way he goes about with these new movies?
Romero?
Yeah.
He's essentially the same. He's a real liberal. I mean, you know, if you don't get it from some of the undercurrents in his zombie films, you certainly can get it if you watch Knight Riders. You know, I mean, he's a real, I don't know that he was ever a hippie, but he definitely was on the side of the, you know, the protesters, the liberals and all that stuff. And he's got a very liberal bent. And I guess he tends to see those zombie films as an opportunity always to say something about problems with the country or with the world, you know, so that in the original, there wasn't anything intended, but because they had a, you know, Dwayne playing the lead, some of that stuff crept in, you know, and then towards the end, they even added stuff, you know, but basically that was just meant to be a complete horror film, but it ended up being recognized as something more. So in Dawn of the Dead, he definitely was making a statement about the mall generation. Mm-hmm. And it, again, in retrospect, that film has been perceived as one of the key films of the 70s because it dealt with, metaphorically, with a phenomenon that was corrupting the country. I mean, and he definitely was doing that intentionally. You know, he had, by now he saw that there was room for subtext and he was going to use it. In Land of the Dead, that's about kind of about terrorism, you know, and about us being, thinking we're safe, you know, pre-9/11, because we're surrounded by sea and we're not in any mm-hmm. of the danger zones, but they're going to come and get us, you know. And in Diary of the Dead, he felt there was something to say about the media, misuse of the media. So I think in a sense, he's remained pretty much the same. What's changed is perhaps the public taste, you know, has drifted in different directions, and also his budgets. I mean, he's not able to perhaps get the budgets he once did that were adequate for what he was doing, and so he's doing smaller films, and he's feeling great about it. When I was on the set of Land of the Dead, which was a big budget film, mm-hmm. with a lot of studio input, he was really tired. I mean, he was beat, and I don't want to speak for George, but I don't think it was a pleasant experience for him. And I had footage of him that I didn't use in the documentary because it was, he was just clearly up against it.
Mm-hmm.
But with Diary of the Dead, I mean, this was a low-budget film like the good old days. And when I went up there, and this was 2 years later, I went up to Toronto and went on the set, and this guy was just lit up like a light bulb. He was so happy to be back in his independent shoes. You know, I think he's a true independent. I really think that the greatest independent filmmaker we had in this country up until he died was John Cassavetes. And then it became George. I think George is the primo independent filmmaker in the United States. And what I mean by that is that, you know, you get somebody like, who is it that did Ocean's 11, Ocean's 12, Ocean's 13?
Oh, you mean the director or the producer?
Yeah, the director.
Wasn't it Barry?
No.
No, wasn't Barry?
Nope. I will remember his name, but the point is, he'll do a really independent film that's real cool, And then he'll turn around and he'll do a Hollywood film that's real cool. George can't do a real Hollywood film. It's not cool for him. He really is genetically structured to just be doing the indie stuff. And so was Cassavetes. Cassavetes did not hold up well under Hollywood supervision. And I think that aspect of George has remained consistent. I think that's what he is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that his most recent films have been smaller. But, you know, the good news is, and people are probably saying, gee, Diary of the Dead, you know, it's gotten completely overwhelmed by the remake of Dawn of the Dead and Zombieland and all these little... No, the truth is, it made a fortune, Diary of the Dead. It did great. It was made cheaply, and because it was made cheaply, it made like 10 times what it cost. Everyone was thrilled, you know, so you should, and no one should ever feel remorse or remiss about George. He's where he wants to be.
Yeah, I'd always wondered that, though. He just doesn't seem like you said, like he fits into the whole studio system like that for whatever reason. And I think that was kind of shown in, like, Day of the Dead, where they, you know, he in order to get the unrated version, he lost a lot of money
mm-hmm,
from studios
that's right.
And things
yeah,
like
I,
that.
I heard about that stuff happening, so I didn't even call up to go down there. I was afraid to visit. As it turned out, he had a great time doing that one.
Yeah, well, exactly.
He said, where were you? You know? So I made a mistake, you know. That was the one I wasn't on. I'm sorry about that. But, no, he doesn't do well under studio pressure. He likes working with a family, you know. He likes working with the same people over and over. And it means as much to, you know, when you ask him, what's your favorite one, he says based on what a good time he had, not aesthetically how the film is.
Yeah.
He doesn't use that as his criteria, you know? So.
Well, I mean, the other thing I think of, too, is we haven't even talked about this really, but you had some experience with, like, the studio aspect of it, I guess, because, I mean, a lot of people don't probably realize you wrote The Substitute, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a pretty popular film. I mean, I can remember watching that film several
times. There's
a lot
of sequels, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it opened up number 2 in the United States, and it had 3 sequels. And they couldn't get rid of me.
Yeah, I mean, how was that? I mean, I guess the point I'm getting at is, how was that experience different from, like, experiences like Street Trash, where it was more independent?
It's terrible. Yeah. I mean, they, you know, Substitute was rewritten. 50% of it was changed, and it was changed. Some of it was okay, the changes. Some of it was ludicrous. You know, I mean, throwing kids out a second or third story window, and they go by the window going, woo, and then they just get up and run away. They would have all had broken arms. I mean, you know, it was supposed to be a sequel, not a sequel. It was supposed to be a follow-up to Street Trash. Bill Chappell was going to play, you know, the substitute, and I was going to use all our people. Nicole Potter was going to play the teacher. You know, And then I got this writing partner, Rocco Simonelli, and I cannot say anything bad about him. He's a great writer, much better with dialogue than me.
Mm-hmm.
And he found this thing sitting in my file cabinet. He said, hey, man, this is a great script. We could sell this to Hollywood. It's just you got to change the ending. You can't die in the end, because I had him dying in the end with this incredible, you know, firefight in this school in Brooklyn. I said, well, you change the ending. Don't show it to me. I don't want to, you know. So so when it went out to Hollywood, it was my script, and then my ending. And then it said, and then you turn the page, and it says just one word, or. And you turn the page, and there's his ending. And what we later heard was that everyone was ripping my ending out because they wanted a franchise. They didn't want the guy to die. They wanted him to go on to another school. So Rocco was my Hollywood conscience. He knew exactly what should be doing. And it was the fastest deal we ever did. I mean, Alive Entertainment picked it up, and they said, this is a fast track. We're going to be shooting this thing right away. And we said, yeah, yeah. A month later, they're in pre-production. I mean, we were astonished
mm-hmm.
that it went that fast. They somewhat kept me in the loop. You know, they'd call and say, who would you like to direct it? I say, John Flynn, guy that did Rolling Thunder. Great job. Well, I don't know. Maybe they approached him. Maybe they didn't. But mm-hmm. they got Rob Mandel, who did a very good job. And then I would keep getting calls. Like, I got a call. They shot in Florida instead of Brooklyn. And I get a call from the art department out of the blue. They said, listen, we're putting together Mark Anthony's car, you know, and we want to put on a license plate. And what do you think it should say? Tough ass? And I said, no, it should say love. You know, I mean, he's a vicious killer. He should have just the opposite. And they said, yeah, you know. And then, so they were still like getting back to me, but it really was only 50% what I'd written with Rocco. And but it did well, you know. So I mean, I can't really complain. I, you know, I've made a lot of money off Document of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
I've made some money off of Street Trash. I made a fortune off of The Substitute.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
You know, that was my retirement fund. So, John Ford used to do, he used to have this policy, two for you, one for me. All his films were studio films, but he'd do two, anything they wanted, the way they wanted. But then they'd have to give him one where he did it himself, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, the way he liked. And I guess that was The Substitute, was my, you know, two for me, one for you.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't mind doing that every now and then.
No. Thing that I know that you're involved in the long-awaited sequel to Slime City, which
oh,
I know.
Oh, God, yes. We screened it. We did a preview screening last week at the School of Visual Arts. I teach the history of horror there. I teach an art history class on horror, and we did a screening of it, and Debbie Rochon came down for it, and also the manager of Forbidden Planet, which is the greatest, like, bookstore novelty store for the genre in New York. And I play Ronald Crump, which is Donald Trump. and it was a thrill to do it because Greg Lamerson, 25 years ago, had been a student of mine at SVA, and he had done Slime City, you know, for nothing. And now, all these years later, he's done a much more upscale film. I mean, this is big, you know. I mean, he shot in Buffalo, which is a city that's not doing well, and it's got a lot of these enormous structures, you know, train stations and things that are derelict, and the city just gave him all this stuff. So now this film is just, you know, slime heads are just roaming through these structures. It's really fun. What else can I tell you about it?
Well, I mean, the one thing I always noticed about it is it always reminded me of Street Trash.
Yeah, the original.
Like,
it's odds because I do believe the comparison, the obvious comparisons between Street Trash and the original Slime City were accidental. I don't know what it was that was going on in New York at that time.
Something was in the water, I guess.
I think so, because if my memory serves, and I was just apologizing for my memory, but if my memory serves, he was shooting around the same time we were. It's just that his took much longer to come out. So it came out a year or two later because it was so low budget, he couldn't get it finished. He kept working on it, you know, editing it when he could, whereas we had the money to finish ours and get it out.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe they were simultaneous. I just ran into something else just like that. It was 2001, and, well, there was a film, oh, yes, Le Samurai by Jean-Pierre Melville. It is so Kubrickian. The opening shot in Le Samurai is Alain Delon lying in that bed. The shot goes on for minutes. It's the shot from 2001 of the guy lying in the bed in the end in that white room, except it's reversed and it's gray. And then all the shots in the film are very cold and distancing. You get this kind of Kubrick-like deliberateness in the setup of the shots and the importance of the shots. And I mean, it just is so reminiscent of his style. But they overlapped. They could not have seen each other's movies. It was just an astounding coincidence. And I think it's probably true of Street Trash and Slime City. But
the definitive version. Is there anything else that you're working towards right now, working on future projects?
Well, yeah, I optioned the remake rights or the sequelization rights to Fiend Without a Face, which was a lovely sci-fi horror film from 1958, a British film. Criterion put it out on DVD just to show how charming it is because they, you know, it's in the company of Ingmar Bergman and Fellini and those people. And it was a little tiny movie with these creeping brains with spines that crawled around like caterpillars and they leaped up and sucked your brains out. I became friends with Richard Gordon, the producer of the original, who's still alive and very active, and he's in New York. And I met him because I did an article about Buster Crabbe. I had done a film with Buster Crabbe called The Comeback Trail back in 71, and I wrote an article about it, which was, I guess, kind of shocking about Buster Crabbe, who played Flash Gordon. And Richard Gordon, who I think must have been the head of the Buster Crab fan club when he was a kid, wrote this letter to me saying, how could you do this? You know, you've got to be wrong. And I said, oh, my God, it's Richard Gordon. So I called him, and I said, well, look, let's get together. And I, when we had lunch, I brought along pictures of Buster Crab in handcuffs in jail and stuff. And Gordon saying, oh, my God, I didn't know about this. But in addition, we became friends. And over the past 10 years, every now and then we get together. And finally, he said, they've optioned, you know, Feeling Without a Face several times. It never got made. How would you like to give it a try? And I said, you got a deal. So the business plan is just about ready.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Gordon looks like, well, let me put it this way. In the original, have you by any chance seen Feeling Without a Face?
No.
Okay, you must check it out. There's an old scientist who causes all the trouble. It's about projecting thought into live creatures, and which then gets out of hand. The old scientist who did it, he's very penitent at the end. It's too late. And I'm sitting there, and I'm talking to Richard about casting, and I'm saying, yeah, you know, this would be good for the lead. This would be good. Who could play the old scientist? Because we want a flashback of the old scientist from the original, because he wanted it to be a sequel. He said, I could play it. So we shot it. We shot his footage, and he's great.
Mm.
The Professor Walgate, so that he wanted it to be a sequel, not a remake. So now, even though it's set in modern times in a think tank in the Berkshires, they get a hold of this old videotape of the original guy being interrogated by the CIA. And it's all scratched, you know, and black and white and grainy. And it's Richard Gordon playing the original part. So,
wow,
cool. That's what I'm working on.
Very cool.
Awesome.
Yeah. And if it gets off the ground, who knows? You know, I mean, it's like a lot of the things I've tried haven't. But this one stands a chance because remakes of classics are very popular. And, you know, and horror is a great genre. It travels, you know. There are certain genres that just don't travel very well around the world. But horror does.
Howdy, folks. Welcome back.
Hello.
Wasn't that killer?
Sorry.
That was a hell of an interview. The best Roy Frumkus interview in the history of horror audio right there, folks.
I would even go as far as say it's the best Roy Frumkus interview I've ever heard in a fortnight.
But of course, as everyone knows, it's that special part of the show. It is Jess Cole's Mile. I know you're tired. She's hungry first.
It's a pattern that I've noticed.
Everything, yeah. She's hungry. Oh, I'm so hungry. Give me food.
Yep.
And after she eats, she gets all
food. Phase two.
I'm so tired.
Now, all the other steps in between are based around complaining about those two things. They're either I want food or I want sleep.
Yeah, but that's see, when I'm not around, here's when I'm not around, man, I got a shit. Oh, I got a poop, Aaron.
What would that matter if you were around or not?
Yeah.
That's more of a private thing between you and Aaron. He likes getting shit on.
Shit on me. Actually, I've never even known her to poop. I'm not sure if she does.
Thank you, everybody, for talking about my bowel.
Usually, the women that shit really fuck it stinks like way worse than your guy.
I remember you having that conversation.
Yeah,
it's weird though. It's almost like
it's like Bigfoot.
like Bigfoot.
And by that I mean you never see it. You know, you might see it.
She sneaks out about 2 o'clock in the morning.
You might,
shit.
Yeah.
She looks up. Are you asleep?
I go to the outhouse in the back.
She
looks really slow.
Tiptoes down to the bathroom.
Tiptoes through the tulips.
Through the shitter.
But yeah, the female shit is like, it smells like regular shit, but it's like mixed with rotted milk and fish. And that's female shit.
Rotted
yeah.
milk and fish.
Yeah. Just my observation.
I've smelled a lot of different kind of shit.
Oh, really?
Where I work, I've smelled shit a lot.
Have you?
And she I was don't the official.
She was the official shit smeller for.
There's not a difference between men and women. Actually, there's men's shit that smells like something died. Like you feel like you can't walk down a hallway because you feel like someone's dead.
Somebody got murdered.
Shit. I'm not saying that
it's
shit doesn't smell.
Oh, it's awful. It's foul.
Old man shit smells like murder.
The thing is, most of the time, like old man shit really is like Bigfoot, though, because they have a hard time shitting old people do. They like shit out gravel.
It's either like hard or
fucking powdered milk.
Powdered milk.
You shit out dust. Anyway.
Let's talk about shit.
We've got a lot of questions, so have at it.
Craig Wagner says, hey, CK, Uncle Bill, and Jessica, I've been a fan of the show for about a year, ever since I stumbled across CK's YouTube video about the Monster Squad. Anyways, I was wondering what were your all's favorite movie or zombie or TV zombies?
Well, I always liked Tarman. It was probably like one of my favorites.
Favorite movie or TV zombies? I like Big Daddy from Land of the Dead.
You bullshit.
Like he about shit himself.
He's like, ah! That's all he would do.
No, I'm super serious. I thought the design for that the softball girl in Land of the Dead was really, really cool.
Oh, that girl
had her
was
jaw
missing. Half jaw.
But now my favorite zombie would probably be Bub, of course. Actually, no, I take it back. It would probably be Flyboy when he turns into a zombie when he's walking down the.
Yeah, I thought the Tar Man zombie was something completely unique looking, though. There was like, there's not a whole lot of zombies that look like that.
Yeah, Tar Man was cool. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them to choose from. The worm zombie from Zombie was cool.
Yeah.
A lot of different ones. Jessica, do you have one?
I can't. I'm drawing a blank. I can't seem to think of anything.
Okay.
At all. Nothing.
You don't have a favorite zombie movie? Just pick a favorite zombie from your favorite zombie movie.
I'm trying to think. I'm drawing a blank, though. I can't.
Okay.
I can't really think of anything.
Oh, no.
He says, with zombies, I feel like less is always more. So my favorites are the ones from Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. Says, yeah, I know they're pretty cheap and simple looking, but I think that because they go so normal that it makes what they're doing so much more creepy. I also feel like Night and Dawn zombies have personalities while most zombies that have come after are just excuses to display really awesome makeup effects. I'd love to hear some official horologists take on this issue. Keep up the good work.
I personally will see zombie movies go away for a while.
Yeah, I do too.
Actually, my favorite zombie is the one where she's riding the horse.
Holy
shit. I think that they went off with that one.
Yeah.
That's the best one. Because not only is she a zombie, but she could ride a horse.
She's riding a horse zombie.
She's mm-hmm. Is that zombie horse? Is that horse a zombie horse?
I always want to know when she bit the horse, does that horse turn into a zombie horse? Or is it just like dead? Or how's that
it's
work?
Like, I'm just so sick of zombies. Like, I don't know.
Well, they've killed it. They've fucking completely oversaturated the whole market now. It's just like vampires. Vampires!
Yeah, I mean, they're not. I don't know. I never thought zombies were scary, really, at all, anyway. So.
I see the one that is truly my favorite, though, I was thinking about it, is the big fat guy that gets shot in the head and falls in the fountain in Dawn of the Dead. That's the best zombie.
Well, a lot of the zombies in Dawn of the Dead didn't even have fucking makeup on, though. They were just standing in the background.
Yeah.
They might have, like, a light dusting, like, that blue shit or whatever it was.
A lot, though. Like, they just walked up to him, and he, like, great mood or something. Went, there's your makeup.
Yeah, there you go. That's probably what they did.
He says, I also live in eastern Kentucky. I'm from
Sorry.
Phelps, a town that's about 40 minutes from Pikeville, and I think it's great to see some local folks making a big bloody splash in the horror world. Where's Phelps?
He just said it's 40 minutes from Pikeville.
Which direction?
Other direction.
Southwest. You're going to use your compass to get there?
My compass? I don't even know which direction I'm facing.
Right now?
Ever since I've gotten here.
You're facing forward.
I don't even know which direction is north, south, east, or west around here. No idea.
Well, you didn't know what Kjarn was until you come down here, so.
It doesn't. Oh, my gosh. So it doesn't matter.
Uh-oh.
It matters which direction I'm going. I feel all mixed up. Scott Sanderson, get your finger out of my face.
He just stuck his finger up his butt and he wouldn't smell it.
Smell that. That's my butt.
Scott Sanderson says, howdy.
Hi, Scott.
I remember in an older episode you guys said that Uncle Bill had a really good recipe for making fudge. Any chance of getting the recipe?
No, it's ancient hillbilly tradition. I can't give away the ancient hillbilly recipe.
I make my own fudge, too.
He's making some fudge right now.
So gross.
It's got nuts in it, too.
You're just disgusting.
It's old-time Pressburg corn fudge.
Corn nut fudge.
Mm-hmm. Jess wants some of it. Get you some of my homemade fudge with a glass of milk.
You forgot the other mood that I go through. It's really crabby.
Are you in that mood right now?
I'm getting there.
Are you?
I'm getting there.
Well, are you there?
If I have to keep listening to Wes's mouth.
You love it and you know it.
Okay. Bethany D. says, first off, even though it's late, thank you, CK and Uncle Bill, for finally having a girl on the show as a regular. It's been a long time coming, and she fits in perfectly. So my question, with all these revisions coming out, do you think classic slashers will die out? The worst shit I've heard was a kid arguing with me that Halloween was a Rob Zombie original. Aw, poor little kid.
Oh, I guess you mentioned that.
He had no idea it even existed before. Are we the last real fans?
You mentioned that, though, with Texas Chainsaw Massacres. Like, kind of took over the... Yeah, what everybody thinks that movie is.
I mean, there's always going to be a large part of the population out there that they're not going to know any better. So it's up to us to educate them.
Slashers really didn't change that much, though. They just kind of got a little bit glossier and a little bit more...
I think the camera style and the way they make the movies now kind of changed. They don't look as good, and or at least to me they don't.
But slashers are really the least anybody's worries right now. I do think that it's zombie movies and vampire movies that are probably just the most fucking in need to die.
Every time we talk about vampires, though, I feel like you're going to talk shit about True Blood.
I'm not going to talk shit about True Blood. There's a lot of other stuff that's like vampire related that they've done, like Twilight, that's a lot worse than True Blood.
The thing is, to me, I don't even put that shit in the horror genre. Like, that's just...
Well, it's kind of like drama. I like that show.
It's kind of like Buffy or something like that. Where it's like, it's too main... To me, horror can't be that mainstream. Horror can't be on the fucking cover of, like, Entertainment Weekly or something.
But it has.
Well, True Blood was. That's not horror.
Twilight was, but
I don't see Twilight as horror.
There's
either.
Tons of stuff that was on the cover of Entertainment
Weekly. Yeah, back in the day, maybe, but not now. Like, it's too... You can't make horror to me, if it's too mainstream, it's going to fucking suck. So
I don't think True Blood was meant to be scary, though, because...
Well, I'm not saying it's scary, but I don't think it's in the horror genre, in my opinion.
There is vampires in it.
There might be vampires in it, but they want to fucking, fuck each other instead
of, like...
I know,
which is kind of a trick. Yeah, it's pretty hot, though, if you think about it.
Yeah, maybe for you. I don't give a rat's ass.
Yeah, you should watch it, though.
No!
Yeah. Anyway.
It lights her clit up, though, so.
Whatever.
But your butthole pucker.
She says, it's great to be back, and I really missed you guys.
It's good to have you back, Beth.
I
miss
Bethany
D to you.
Back, too. I missed her. We need more females around here.
I think there's a lot of girls on.
I swear.
Actually, in all the
Yeah, all these girls, hey, show up at a fucking convention.
Makes
us feel special because we feel, there's so many guys go around and stuff, makes us feel a little gay.
There's too much testosterone. It's gross.
There's too many wings.
Yeah. That's why, hell, if we ever get a chance, like a female fan comes up, you won't see a picture of me not with my big arm around, like, woo. We'll hug up with you.
That's our policy.
That's our policy.
We get close with a dead pit fan, the female fan.
We get uncomfortably close to you.
We'll creep you fuckers out.
That's why they go away.
I like that shit.
Ben says, what depresses you more, modern movies, modern rock, or modern WWE? God. They all pretty much make me suicidal.
That's easy. Modern rock for me, easy. No question.
I guess that probably modern film is still watchable to me. I can't listen to fucking music. I mean, there's nothing that I listen to on the radio.
I wouldn't say, I mean, I think the pop music, as opposed to 10 years ago, is way better than it was 10 years ago.
I can't listen to any of it.
Fucking rock music is like, to me, non-existent.
Yeah, and then there's WWE, which has, in my opinion, gotten progressively worse and worse and worse over the years, too. It's all pretty bad right now. But I'd say, if I had to put it in order, it would be, like, film is still, I can still watch a lot of the films that come out, and there's always like independent films that are really good, and then I would put WWE and then music being the worst out of all of it.
Holler.
Okay. he says, what do you think about the Beatles?
I love the Beatles. No, they're definitely my top three bands. I've got every one of their albums. Listen to that stuff like constantly. Learn to play all the music or as much music as I could. I don't know what else to say about them. They're pretty much the best band that's ever existed in terms of like everybody in the band had like a hit song and everybody in the band, they created an entire format that like every other band followed after that. Harmonies, you know, four-piece band, harmony. Lead guitar, solo, kind of stuff.
Yeah, they're all right.
I like them. The only song I ever attempted to learn on the guitar for a period of a week was a Beatles song, and then I gave it up.
What did you try to learn?
Rocky Raccoon.
What was it?
Rocky Raccoon. That was the only one I ever attempted to try to play.
I don't really, I mean, you know, I don't hate them or anything. They're better than the Ramones.
Anyways,
gosh. They were, a lot of people consider them the very first boy band.
I guess they were, yeah, in terms of that. However, they did, like, write all their own music and play their own instruments. So I don't know if you really classify them as a boy band.
Some people do.
A man band.
They were really boys, though, when they, I mean, they couldn't have been what, they were still in their teens, weren't they?
I think early 20s.
You're a man when you're in your 20s.
Now you're a man.
Oh, Merle, Merle, Merle.
He also says, do you think any important, well-known celebrities listen to the show?
No.
Just no.
No, I don't think so either.
Here's the thing, and a lot of people, I don't know if they just don't have the balls or they're just too nice. People at horror conventions are not celebrities. You know, people that, a lot of the people we have on the show aren't celebrities. Let's be fucking honest.
Yeah, I mean, if you say mainstream celebrities, you'd be talking about like, what, like people like fucking Matt Damon and like Lindsay Lohan or something? Probably not. I mean, I'd say nobody.
Lindsay Lohan really isn't that A-list, is she?
Not anymore. I'm just saying, like, in terms of celebrities that people would know, I don't think anybody even has any kind of interest in.
I don't think they have enough time. Because they're really, like, the A-list celebrities, they really are really busy.
You have to book interviews with their agents primarily, and they go on these little tours where they talk about said movie and all that bullshit.
But even people like Rob Zombie that aren't really A-list celebrities but are more well-known than probably, like, a lot of people don't listen to this show. And I think it's simply due to the fact that, like you said, they wouldn't have time to listen to it. And they don't give that much of a shit. Like, and they don't like anybody to criticize them.
But, I mean, who knows? Like yeah. Eli Roth, I know, has listened to the show at some point.
Mostly because we kind of forced him to bombarding his MySpace pages and stuff.
As far as horror celebrities go, who knows? I don't know.
Not a lot of people even know who Eli Roth is, though.
Yeah. Not anymore, no.
But mainstream celebrities, if there are any, hell, I don't know them.
That'd be funny if Clint Eastwood listens. That'd be great.
It's my favorite show. You guys are fucking hilarious.
He says, can you bring back Dial H for horror? You've got a female voice to work with now.
Jess wouldn't do it.
No.
We would.
What is it?
Have you ever heard about Dial H for horror?
We did it like two or three times, and it's become legendary over the years.
What we would do is we would call video stores around this area.
Which are none anymore.
Well, yeah, that's true. But there's still some mom-and-pop stores left, and we would call them, and we would either ask for a hilariously, like, ludicrous title, like fucking Ghoulies 3, Ghoulie Goes to College, or something like that, if they had that. Or, like, he would do
Dusty Rhodes
voices and ask him for stuff. So they want us to do that again, but they want you to participate, basically, like, in making prank phone calls to video stores.
Oh, no, I can't do that.
She's chicken shit.
Just lay that out there.
I don't do stuff like that.
She's good. She's a good girl.
Oh.
You're pushing it.
Oh.
I'm fine.
You are so lucky you're on the other side of the room.
You ain't gonna do nothing to me.
I'd smack you.
No.
I would.
No.
Critter Fan says, hey guys and gal, I'm not sure if this question has been asked before or not, so I'm going to ask it anyways.
No.
Over the past 5 or 6 years, Dead Pit has had a ton of horror goodness for us almost every week, and I was just curious as to what your most listened to show was of all time.
It was the Amy Lynn Best interview. It was all downhill after that.
I seriously don't know, though. You probably looked at that stuff more than I have.
Man, okay. A lot of people would think that the John Carpenter interview would have been the most popular. The most popular shows never revolved around fucking interviews.
It's weird, though, but... Yeah, I think the most popular shows always end up being the ones where we don't have anybody on. It's just us doing some sort of stupid
show.
Yeah,
so I don't really even know. I mean, I don't keep track. I don't have, like, a... little graph that shows the most popular show
you
ever.
You should get a graph.
No.
I do know that, chart. Like, a few weeks ago was our most popular week ever as far as, like, number of people that visited the site, which I don't even know why, but...
Because we're killer. That's why.
Everybody was bored.
I guess.
They go to us for news
we got, like,
tornadoes.
We broke a lot of the stuff, like, a lot of the news on... DVDs and stuff, and that would always bring a lot more people to the site. Like, we broke the news on the Monster Squad coming to DVD, Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. That was another big one that people were going crazy about.
Mm-hmm.
So, stuff like that usually gets a lot more people to check the site out.
And whenever we do specialty shows, too, that when you can cross-promote with, like Friday 13th sites or Halloween sites, stuff like that, those shows always do better.
And, of course, those shows do good, too. Not to Jess.
I'm sorry. I can't hear.
Yes, Cole. Yes, Cole. Read the next question.
I'm still going to finish. He says, also, do all of you have any particular episode that you like the most? And thanks, and keep up the good work.
As far as whole episodes, I don't know, but, like, I can't really remember particular episodes. Like, whenever moments on the show that were hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The time Horror Queen called right before she was getting ready to go up on the, you know, the stripping pole.
Right.
That was great.
That was awesome.
Mr. Blonde. Calling from Scotland. We couldn't understand a fucking word he was saying.
Right. We do need to bring back the call-in section of the show there for a little while.
I like the one where that guy had called in with the voicemail.
Oh, yeah.
Aubrey or something?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was the voicemail portion. That was a little weird.
I like the one where he said, pickle your butt sack.
There was one time... Yeah, that was an awesome show. There was one time when a guy called in, though, this is not too long ago, was trying to promote, like, an independent film, and just hung up on him, like, no. which I thought was awesome.
If we did bring the call-ins back, it'd be for like maybe a special show or something. Right. Maybe, you know.
No, I don't want to bring him back full time. I just want to bring him back like for a brief.
Because we did have a lot of hilarious shit that happened.
In terms of shows that we've done recently, though. Jesus Christ.
Like some of the interviews, what were some of the favorite interviews?
Remember
doing?
Sherry, Moon, Zombie.
Oh, yeah.
That was your favorite
one?
Yeah,
that was my absolute favorite one. I liked the Derek Mears interview. I thought that was a good interview. He was a lot of fun. This interview that we did here was, I thought it was a really good interview, but I'm like a big geek for stuff that's behind the scenes of the Romero movie.
I thought Linnea Quigley, when we interviewed her, I liked that. I liked the John Carpenter one. We couldn't ask for a better like interview with John Carpenter, I don't think.
Right.
Hell, I don't
always
know.
Like the roundtable shows, too. Like, yeah. Those always seem to go really, really well. So,
what about you, Jess? What's some of your favorite interviews?
I don't know.
Don't play dumb. Come on, tell us. I know you've got like a whole fucking catalog of shit in Michigan.
A catalog of what?
Like, were you stalking Dead Pit?
I wasn't stalking you guys.
Yep.
Whatever.
Yeah, you were.
I was not stalking you guys at all.
You got a Dead Pit shrine up there in Michigan. Don't lie. Now tell us. Just name us one of your favorite interviews.
I don't know.
She does. Whatever. Next question.
Next question. John Smallberry says, what do you guys think about the new video on demand service that they are proposing? I read an article that outlined how the service will work. It said, first run movies will be offered 60 days after they open in the theaters for the low price of $30. Already, big name directors detest this by saying they have that having a pristine copy of a movie 60 days after its initial release will only encourage the piracy problem. Also, it would deal a deadly blow to movie chains. What do you think?
If it's $30, then I wouldn't touch it anyway. God damn it. Why would you pay $30 for something that's on the
main? Most, you said it's 60 days after the...
Yeah, he says, offered 60 days after they open in theaters.
Well, hell, most Blu-rays and DVDs come out within 60 days of...
Yeah, all you have to do is wait maybe like a month or two more and then the movie will come out on DVD.
I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it'll work.
People are just trying to make more money.
The movie studios, like, they should be worrying about how to get people in the fucking theater again.
Well, ever since Charles Band kind of talked about that and I first became really aware of the possibilities of the video on demand shit and all that stuff, like, I just always thought it was a bad idea. I've never really been behind that whole idea. And maybe it's where I'm not from that generation where I don't really download a whole lot of stuff like that. I don't do it. I like to buy DVDs and Blu-rays and stuff. But I just think it's kind of fucking silly.
Hell, I'm not going to buy a DVD or a Blu-ray for $30, let alone a fucking like something with a cable where you download something that's $30 for a movie. That's fucking stupid.
Also, it might depend on the area that you're in, because up there we had a ton of really nice movie theaters to go to. That they were all really nice. The popcorn wasn't super expensive. I mean, it was still expensive, but it was really nice, all the theaters. And so, even then, I would rather go to the movie.
What are you saying? Theaters here aren't nice?
I don't know.
I'm sick of her insulting us.
I'm not insulting you. I'm just saying that a lot of times it would bring, like you said, the theaters need to worry about how you're going to get more people in there. Well, the theaters up there were kind of nice.
The thing is, though, as long as people can download shit off torrent sites and stuff for free, then they ain't going to spend $30 on download.
I think that's
shit.
What they're worried about. That
yeah, well,
the,
there's
they're gonna
yeah, there'll always be one person that'll
yeah.
buy it and then put
yeah.
it up.
There's
you know.
Always gonna be somebody who does that.
So and then the other.
And then with the torrent, all you have to do is share it, and then it's just.
And the thing why is, not have it be like a dollar? Like if it was like a red box or something, then more people might do it. You might order more stuff like on
yeah,
demand.
They don't make any money that way.
Well, how the hell they make
and
money?
And then when they do
shit?
That,
they're not.
When the DVD or Blu-ray comes out, nobody's gonna fucking buy it. Either.
Nobody's buying anything these days anyway, though, really.
They're just trying to figure out what people are going to... The problem is that it's not about what people are going to want. People want the shit. People want to go to the movies. People want to watch all these movies, but they'd rather do it for free because everything else is so expensive.
I don't
people
think...
People can't live.
I don't think people want to do shit, though, really. Like, if you listen to people that are on... Like, a lot of people on our board and stuff, they don't want to go to the movies. They don't want to leave their fucking house.
Because they can't.
I don't know if it's because they can't. A lot of them are just like... They're
conditioned to get shit for free.
Well they spend
the
time...
Only way to get any, that's the only thing to do now.
They spend all the time on the internet.
You start learning that it's too expensive to go out to eat and it's too expensive to go anywhere. So you stay in the house and you try to get everything for free because you're worried that if you spend any money, you won't be able to get by. That's the problem.
I think people are just cheap assholes nowadays.
Well, like,
look at no bullshit. If you've got enough money to spend $60 a month on the internet, buying DVDRs, whatever else, you can fucking rent a movie.
From
you're not gonna be yeah. Mm-hmm. You can rent a dollar movie or something like that. You don't have to fucking download it, but you do.
I think here's the thing that I was trying to say is that the majority of people that really, really dig movies and stuff that I've noticed, they don't want to interact with other people. Not just that they don't want to, they just don't want to go to a fucking movie and like be around other people and stuff like that. They'd rather watch it at home.
People are assholes, though.
You can pause it.
The thing is, there's always going to be a market for people that want a physical copy of something, okay? Now, the problem is there might not be enough of a market for a lot of these mainstream studios to mass produce the stuff like they're used to now. But the thing is, once you get into the digital download thing, okay, where you never get any physical copy of anything, nobody's going, to me personally, I've never ever bought an MP3 or any kind of digital download movie or anything like that. Because to me, you're not getting anything for your fucking money. You don't have anything physical. If your hard drive goes down, you're fucked.
Yeah, that's the problem. Is that like I'll download a lot of music off of iTunes or something, but then if my computer crashes, it's gone. That's it. You don't really have the hard copy for it to be on. It's not going to get ruined.
So to me, and I don't download, you know, illegal movies and shit like that. Usually. Occasionally, you know.
A majority of the time.
I'm not like some people. I mean, I've seen certain people. I'm not going to name names, but he's a good friend of ours, that it has thousands upon thousands of movies on DVD-R. Okay, there are people like that, or have them on hard drives or whatever else. And when you do that, though, when everything is a digital download, more and more people are going to be like, hey, I'm not paying for that. I can just download it for free. I'm not getting anything for it anyway. So I'm just going to download it.
So there.
See what I'm saying?
Anyways, he says, personally, I download a ton of stuff. So this guy does. But I would hate
to see... Of course he does. Smallberry's a cheap asshole.
God. He says, but I would hate to see movie theaters closing up shop and going the way of the drive-in.
Movie theaters will never close because the studios will always find something. Like if it's,
he says. Also, a couple weeks ago on the Horrors of 1987 show, you were talking about Prince of Darkness. I sincerely believe it's Carpenter's second best movie. The first being The Thing. You should really revisit it. I would love to hear a review on it on the show. it just begs for a re-release.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think Halloween will always be Carpenter's best movie. But, I mean, Prince of Darkness is one that's underrated. Not a lot of people talk about it at all.
I don't think I've even ever seen it.
I've got it, if you'd like to watch it.
No.
It's on like a... The thing is...
I just said no.
Why not?
Because I don't want to.
Oh, you'll fucking watch it.
Don't grin. You'll do what we say. Let me tell
you
something.
You'll watch it, and I'll make you enjoy it.
I actually think that'd be a good one to do a commentary over, because people would buy the fuck out of that.
They would. It's easy to find, too.
Yeah.
P.S., you might not want to read this, so.
Yeah, we might not want to.
So. Okay. And then he says, suck a dick, everyone, John Salt, small berries.
Well,
suck a dick to you, too.
You two can go suck a dick.
You're the best at it, though, Wes.
Oh, you can gag on him. Not going to gag on Aaron, so he's got a little thimble dick.
I knew that was coming. I was waiting on it.
You were just waiting for it, yeah.
I got a little thing I do.
You have a complex, though. You really worry.
How you said that before, whatever. Can you not say anything else?
You just talk so much about the size of other men's penises because you're really worried about the size of your own.
But he's fucking talking about it worse than me.
Hey, I don't ever hear him mention the fact that you have a tiny dick.
Before your sorry ass come along, you did.
I don't like talking about dick. I'll leave that up to him.
You don't have to
worry.
He
don't like talking about dick. He just likes eating.
Don't worry about his dick. You can worry about your own dick. Okay.
All right, let's go.
Newt138 says, okay, love the MWO show this week, but a question. During it, I swear I heard someone let loose a fart. Did this happen? And then he says, I figured maybe the baby was making me gassy.
It was. That's what it was.
Yeah. I knew you were going to say that. No.
We've sort of gotten used to it. I mean, we have to pinch her nose. And
yeah. Although she does make this unearthly fucking noise every now and then, but it's not a fart. It's like something that comes up. It's like a...
Have you
hiccup all, slash
have
burp
I
or
like
something?
A hiccup.
It's like it sounds like this. You'd be sitting there and just out of the blue, like I'll be watching movies, but I'm like, what the fuck?
I do not.
Have y'all gotten to that special point though where you're comfortable farting around each other?
No.
Why do you do that?
You keep asking
you
that, but no.
That all the time.
Well, that's when you know you're really comfortable around one another when you fart around.
No, when you know you're really comfortable is when you fart and hold her head under the covers. That's when you know like it's reached a new level.
That would be killer.
I get the hiccups. So, I'll do that.
Don't you? Like, I find myself at work having to fart, and I don't want to fart in front of anybody. But, like, eventually, you just have to fucking let loose. I mean, come on.
I do the same thing. I'll fart in somebody else's room and walk out of it.
Actually, like, if I'm bored at work, I have the iPhone, you know, and I've got this recording device on it, and I've got, like, a compilation of long farts.
You never know when you're going to need that.
It's actually pretty fucking funny. I'll play it for you motherfuckers after we go off here. It's hilarious.
Yeah, I want to know, though, who farted on the last show, though? That was funny.
I don't remember
anybody, but...
I think it might have been you, but you...
No, it wasn't.
Yeah.
I can't stand it when a woman farts, so that's the nastiest thing.
He thinks that women are just so disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like anything about women? You think that we smell?
Well, the thing is, like, I don't know, like... Women's farts stink pretty damn, like, they're pretty, like, at my work, these girls, they're nasty. I mean, maybe that's just them. They're all nastier and fuck. And they fart, and it's not too, doesn't smell too good.
I have to say that some of the nastiest shit I've ever smelled, though, has come from a woman's anus.
There you go.
Here we go. Didn't we have the same conversation, like, months ago?
Probably did.
Yeah, because I remember we were watching Black Swan, and you're like, oh, women stink.
Blah, I wonder blah, blah. If Natalie Portman farts. And if she does fart, I wonder if it's in those
I'd probably take
cords.
A whiff of her fart. I'm going
to... You bottle it.
I didn't hail it.
That's gross.
Go!
Aaron... I can't... Edgo? Says,
Adele?
A gel.
Is he Canadian?
I don't know. He says the May of the Dead festivities must include a commentary for Burial Ground, the greatest zombie movie of all time. That is all.
Isn't there like some sort of commentary for
that? Yeah, we actually did a Burial Ground commentary. I can probably put it up as a digital download on the site for $2.99.
What?
We did it live at Whorehound Weekend.
Badam. The great Michael Slipcase Felcher's on that one, too.
That's true.
Mike Morrissey says, hey, guys, have you ever seen Postmortem on Fearnet? It's a talk show hosted by Mick Garris.
I've heard about it. I haven't seen it.
I enjoy the interviews he does with all the great directors. Anyways, have you heard of the band? Is that Symphony X? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I've seen them perform. Seeing them perform next weekend. Power metal rules.
Symphony X. I've never heard of them.
No. We're not really into, like,
power metal.
Power metal, Euro metal, doom metal, death metal.
Yeah.
Norwegian metal.
I'm not into any metal band that's like post-1990 usually.
Yeah. A lot of the bands that are out now, you get like one or two things. Hyper fast fucking guitar playing with some woman or something that sounds like an opera singer, or like hyper fast guitar playing with somebody that sounds like they're taking a shit.
Yeah. I mean, I really don't like, if you like that sort of thing, it's fine. But to me, a lot of the metal bands now with the death growl shit.
You sound like a gorilla.
Yeah, that's what they sound like.
Yeah, they really do.
They sound like they're fucking vomited up shit or something. And the thing is, to play that sort of music doesn't take any skill at all. Like, because we both play music and we see what they're playing.
Mm-hmm.
They're playing these tuned down guitars that, like, we told you about drop D tuning, and that's basically the same philosophy, but it's like drop. What is it? F?
Yeah, it's something ridiculous.
They drop it down
C
like,
or something?
Yeah. And it's these one bar chords they use with the fingers. Anybody can play that sort of shit. It just, I like metal when it actually still sort of sounds like music, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And if you want to really think about it, the song that we have for Dead Pit on the Road that we came up with, which is as good as any real death metal song, we wrote in literally about 5 minutes.
Yeah,
and recorded it.
We did it completely as a joke, dude. Yeah. So, somebody was asking what the lyrics were for Dead Pit on the Road. I was like, there are no fucking lyrics. It's both. And then the chorus is like, Dead Pit on the Road. That's it.
Yeah.
I think Jess is getting chill bumps over me using my melodic death metal vocals.
I wasn't even paying any attention.
Bullshit.
Oh, well, back to the Mick Garris thing. I've never seen that show. I've never really been on Fearnet, actually.
Well, yeah.
But I do respect him, though, because he was doing roundtables and shit 30 years ago with a lot of those directors.
Not
like,
before us, though. We were doing them.
Yeah, like Landis and Carpenter and Hooper and all those. He was doing that stuff. You know, before it was even considered.
And Sergio Carbucci.
He did an interview with Andrew Bianacchi.
Quit yawning over here.
Let's go!
Possum Grits. Ow!
I like it.
Possum Grits.
Possum Grits is the best name I've ever heard.
It was
some
Possum Grits.
Well,
yeah.
How do you want me to talk?
I want you to talk more Southern.
I can't do that. Possum Grits says, what is your favorite Dario Argento film and why?
Bag of Level.
My favorite Dario Argento film. Shit, that's actually kind of tough when I think about it.
My favorite one that nobody ever talks about is Opera. I like it.
Opera.
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 Opera. Dude, I don't know. Honestly, like, I like all of them, like of that era, Suspiria, Phenomena, Inferno, Opera. They're all basically the same type of movie. It's hard to differentiate. Actually, no, I'll take that back. I do think that Deep Red is probably one of my favorites.
I like Phenomena quite a bit, too.
And, I like Tenebra, or Tenebrae, or however you want to pronounce it.
Tenebrae.
Tenebra. I'd say that was probably my
favorite. What's your favorite?
I like Inferno.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Inferno is really like a beautifully filmed movie. It just doesn't make any sense
at
all.
It's definitely the most like incomprehensible.
I still can't have no idea. I just watched that movie like 3 weeks. I could not tell you the plot of that fucking movie. If you asked me what it was.
I kind of liked it, though.
I just remember a lot, like that one woman swimming, you could see her titties.
Great, yeah. Great shot film, but not.
The Blu-ray's great, too.
Mm.
So.
Manic Exorcism says, just letting the three of you know, I went to see Insidious due to your review and really, really enjoyed it. Thanks for giving the word about a movie that deserves some praise. If you guys hadn't, I would have never gone and seen the movie at all. And yes, there were moments that really creeped me out. I loved it. That guy's really nice.
The thing is, I think that we're the reason it made so much money at the box office.
I do think we're directly responsible.
James Wan needs to give us some money.
Yeah. And I'm glad you enjoyed it, though. You've got some sense.
Allison, is that Boheme? Courtney? Can't pronounce her middle name.
Allison Boheme Courtney, baby.
Says, what is the most obscure heavy metal band that you like? For me, it would be an 80s thrash band named Virus Force Recon.
Oh, yeah.
Is the album.
Fuck, I've got all the Virus Force Recon albums.
Yeah.
Who doesn't?
I don't know. There's a couple like Saxon is probably one that like hardly anybody knows what the hell it is. They always think I'm talking about John Saxon. And
back when he made that album.
Budgie is another.
Budgie's probably the one. I like Stormtroopers of Death though. Nobody ever talks about them. They were just SOD, like the initials.
Solid.
They were. Yeah, it really was. It had who's the guy from Anthrax? Scott Ian. He was one of the guitar players.
God, I can't stand that guy.
And then I forget who the singer was, but it was a really good band, really good thrash band.
What about you, Jeff Cole?
I like Saxon, but I also like how you guys introduced me to Budgie, though. I like them, too.
Well, who couldn't like Budgie?
Budgie's not really thrash metal, though. Did it say thrash metal?
I don't know.
Obscure heavy metal.
I don't like thrash metal.
Obscure heavy metal. And then she also says, what do you think of bands doing the reunion thing?
I think it's pathetic.
If it's good,
I don't know. What does that mean? Like
bands, like how Flock of Seagulls broke up forever ago, and then they try to get back together.
It's hilarious.
Wow. I'm serious, though. Flock of Seagulls had, like, really good song.
I remember hearing something recently about Rat getting back together and, like, touring, and I was like,
Isn't one of the guys from Rat dead, though?
I think that maybe one of them died recently or something. But
they could dig him up and
like,
Stephen
Piercy and all those guys, they got back together, like, 20
Journey
years.
Journey should get back together.
Stephen Piercy died, didn't he? I thought he died.
He may have. I was talking, though, like, they did get back together and were performing as Rat there for a long time.
I mean, look, if a band wants to get back together and have fun and do it, I mean, that's fine. I mean, they're entitled to do that. I just think, though, bands like fucking Stryper, like Stryper is still playing. Like, who the fuck wants to see Stryper anymore, though, really? I mean.
I do. I want to see Stryper
Jessica
a lot.
Does.
I do like I was sitting here thinking more obscure bands. Like Diamond Head is a really awesome band that nobody ever talks about anymore. And there was one band, I think the name of them, I just found them recently, was something like fucking Batman or something like that. What the fuck was it?
Batman.
I'm telling you, it was something like that.
Gotham?
Gotham. That was
Shit.
It. Yeah. It was like Gotham City or Gotham or something like that. Because I remember, like, I started listening to their whole, this one whole album, like, all the way through on YouTube, and it was fucking awesome.
The Gotham City Shithens.
But the thing about bands like that is, you cannot find any of that stuff. Like, you will never find a CD of that, or album even of that, to listen to. You have to listen to it
online. The weird thing is, like, when I was getting into Saxon, I loved
You were getting into them.
I loved
he loves getting into men.
Saxon is a band. God damn it.
Are you sure?
Oh, you're talking about John Saxon.
Saxon's
ass. It was just bizarre because you remember, I think it was Disc Jockey. You remember that story?
Yeah.
Going to get used
it now went out of business.
I found almost the entire back catalog of Saxon CDs. And that shit is so fucking rare to find. Like, I don't know what it was. It was almost like Saxon was calling my name, by God.
Mm-hmm.
He says, Wes. Wes, come to me.
What's your favorite Saxon song if you like Saxon?
I don't say I like them so much. I know that my dad liked them. I listened to them when my dad listened to them.
Well, you can't name one song.
No.
Well, you're not a fan in Hush.
I never said I was a fan. I said I like them. But I don't know any of their music.
Oh God.
Shit. See if you can name this one.
Though. Did I just not tell him that I wouldn't be able to?
What was that one? You don't know. You're not a fan, so don't lie to me.
I just told him.
We just stopped. What was that one? Fuck you.
So,
oh,
you really
man.
Make me mad tonight, Jess. I just wanted to let you know.
It was Crusader, though, I know.
Yeah.
It was killer.
Why am I making you mad?
Because you're lying to me.
How am I lying?
You're trying to make me like you more by saying you like Saxon.
I don't give a shit.
She don't know Saxon, though. That pisses me off.
Mm.
Oh, my gosh.
Pisses me off, too.
Yep. Makes me mad. I'm mad.
I do know that you're both aggravating the shit out of me. I just wish we'd get on with this. God.
Well, she's not doing her job, Uncle Bill.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, my God.
Come on.
I can't stop.
You do it, Jess.
Jacob Mahan says, hey, guys, just to let you know, it's Mahan, like hand with no D.
What the hell were we pronouncing it as?
I didn't.
Mahan.
I don't know how I was pronouncing it before.
We could call him Jacob Shithand.
He says, also congrats on the baby, and you should name it Cunt Wrecker.
Ha! It's all Cunt Wrecker! Shit, fucker!
That would be so killer. Now you guys are going to have infant-sized Dead Pit shirts. And he says, when are you guys going... What does that say?
When are you guys going to sell, make a Dead Pit porno in the vein of the Triple Exorcist? When are we going to make a porno?
You two should make a porno.
Well, we actually...
That would be
It's an Easter egg.
Little do you know, we've already made it. And you can find it if you just buy...
Hey, there's Dead actually video footage of Uncle Bill giving me a rectal exam.
Yeah, with the broom handle. It's a lot of fun. I'm rooting around in there looking like I'm looking for my car keys for like 30 minutes.
He says, what are your guys' favorite foods, not Chinese?
I know that's something Jess will definitely know.
Go, Jess, go. What's your favorite foods?
My favorite foods? I really like pizza.
Yummy.
And ice cream.
Delicious.
I like anything sweet.
Right. So you have the palate of a 3-year-old child then.
Yeah, did you eat all those Reese's eggs? Dude, I had one.
Dude, I never touched any of them.
I had one.
So I don't know what happened to them, but
I had one.
You
put them in the fridge and that was it.
We got Easter candy and I swear to God, I never saw any of it.
Did you get an Easter basket?
It disappeared.
I got Easter candy and I ate all my...
Now you like some weird shit too.
I love Middle Eastern food. Oh my God, I miss it so much.
Yeah, we ate at that Middle Eastern place.
No, that was Thai.
Oh, we about got killed in there.
That was Bangkok Dangerous.
Yeah,
I like Thai food too, but...
No, you really do, I mean...
There's Thai food. I like the Thai food, but I like the Middle Eastern food. I like Indian food. What else do I like?
Like Italian food.
I do like some Italian food. It depends. I would really like some Middle Eastern food though right now. What are you doing?
I like, Chinese food.
He says not including Chinese food.
I like Spaniard food. I like barbecued chicken. I like crab legs. Any kind of seafood, pretty much. I love it.
Which is weird because a lot of men don't like seafood.
Really?
Yeah. Not a lot of men like seafood.
A lot of fuckers around here won't eat anything like, unless it's a cheeseburger, hot dog, or pizza.
Mm-hmm. I like hot dogs, too.
They're like, what is that, seafood? God, no, I ain't gonna eat that shit.
Chinese food, that fucking dog. Fuck you.
You enjoy that, you cats, boy. It's like, people are so fucking retarded around here when it comes to food.
Yeah, I would say that, actually, since you got me eating Thai food, that would probably be one of my favorite foods. And then, Mexican and Italian are my two other favorites, and I like Chinese as well. I like pasta, though. Anything related to pasta or noodles, like Chinese noodles or anything.
You ain't eat my cat.
I'm going to eat your damn cat. But noodles would make a hell of a meal. Be eating on her for days.
You ain't going to eat noodles.
I like Thanksgiving. That's a category.
Yeah, Thanksgiving food, yeah. It's always.
I'm not done yet.
But you're going to keep on. You're going to hurt somebody with that.
What are your guys' favorite obscure horror and non-horror movies?
What? Obscure horror and non-horror.
Yep.
God damn it, you should know like what our horror stuff is. We talked about that for years.
What about non-horror then?
So our favorite, I'll tell you one that we both really, really like and you've never seen yet. We need to do like a commentary or something over this or try to watch again. It's King Frat.
Yeah. That's an awesome movie.
King Frat is like, I guess it's an Animal House ripoff from Canada.
Yeah, it's also known as Delta House in the U.S. It's like, I'll put it up because y'all going to hurt somebody. It's a really, really low budget Animal House ripoff. I mean, I don't know what the budget was like on it, but it was really like, you can tell by the, it's almost like the, if you've seen the Meatball sequels, it looks kind of like that same production company.
And it has a title song that will fucking forever be ingrained in your mind for the rest of your life if you ever hear it like one time. King Fat King Fat! King Fat King Fat!
Yeah, that'd be a good, we should do like a commentary over that.
Yeah, that would be one, though, a favorite obscure movie, I guess.
That's never come out. I don't know what the deal is. Never come out officially in the U.S. either.
I'm hoping that one we got in recently, though, will be another favorite. I've never seen it, and you said it was awesome. It was that Body Slam. And then there's a couple more we'll talk about later, too.
Obscure horror.
Shit on obscure horror. We've talked about horror films, like, a million times.
I like that one documentary you had me with. I don't know if that's very obscure or not, but I had never heard of it. That documentary?
No, it's mainstream as hell. I mean, in terms of documentary. You're talking about an American movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, I'd never heard of it until you made me watch it. I thought it was hilarious.
What about, you haven't seen the Paradise Lost documentaries yet either?
No.
I can't believe that you've never seen those.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you yet again.
Yep. I'm used to it.
I'm just a big disappointment to him.
Oh.
Aw.
I like you, Jess. I'm
whatever. Zachary Wells says, hey, guys, did you hear that Victor Salva has officially signed on to direct the remake of Stand By Me? The remake in that?
I think that's got to be a joke.
Is he going to be called, is he going to rename it Candy Store?
Stand By Me at the Candy Store?
No, he's going to rename it Candy Store because he'll be like a kid in one in that movie. Ooh, little boy.
He's going to rename it Sit On Me.
That's a joke.
Victor Salva, I think it is a joke, though. Victor Salva is a known pedophile. That's why
he loves blowing little boys.
That's why it would be so funny.
Ew.
He does. It's a proven fact.
Gross. Eric like, Hansen.
That little boy ain't got no pubes on his dick.
Oh, come. Okay, gross. Anyways, hey CK Uncle Bill, besides part 5, what are each of your 3 favorite Friday the 13th films?
Aside from part 5, that's what it said.
Our 3 favorite in no particular order. I like watching the first one. Part 4. Part 4. And probably like part 8.
Whew. I'm going to say definitely part 4. The first one, and until we watched it again recently, I always liked part 7, but when we watched it again, I was like, oh, this movie's kind of shitty. We watched it at Scarefest again. Mm-hmm. So I'll say 4, 1, and 6 then.
What we should do next week for Friday the 13th is like, because when we did the first Friday the 13th Spectacular, we went through all the Friday the 13th movies.
Mm-hmm.
But this time we could go through them with Jess. We've never done that.
God, yeah, but what we say about them again that we haven't already said?
I don't know.
We just let you do the talking.
Feedback.
Yeah. Okay, what are yours, Jess, besides from part 5?
Oh, that question wasn't directed towards me. It was only for you guys.
Yeah, well, you can answer it, too.
She doesn't like the Friday the 13th movie.
I do, too. I like 1, 3, and 4.
I didn't think 3 was your favorite there for a while, wasn't it?
3 is my favorite.
I used to like 3 a lot more than I do now for some reason. I don't know.
I like 3 a lot. It's just fun to me.
Do you like 5?
Yeah, I do like 5.
Well, good.
But he says besides part 5.
Well, I'm just asking you, though. I'm not talking about
like
him.
I do like part 5.
Well, good.
Well, good.
At least we won't have any arguments there.
No, there's no arguments. That's good. The next question. Amber Atrophy says, this really is Amber Atrophy this time. Tom Thrill Me Atkins with a shotgun versus Rutger Hauer Hobo with a shotgun. Who wins?
At this point in time, I would definitely have to say it'd be Rutger Hauer.
Rutger Hauer always got to aim for the colostomy bag. He'd be over with.
You dislodge that, then he doesn't have a chance.
Yeah.
That's so fucking sad, too. You know why that's even more sad to me that whole Tom Atkins thing went down? Though, because that dude was the very first guy that I ever got any kind of response back from. We were doing the through-the-mail autographs and stuff, and he actually was the very first guy to ever send me back a picture signed or anything like that. And the first time we met him, he was fucking awesome to both of us, like me and him. And then that shit had to happen, which will now forever, like, taint my view of Tom.
Well, it's not just that shit, but we've heard all kinds of stories about him being a douchebag.
Mm-hmm.
He must be bipolar or something. That's the only thing I can figure.
I think he's an alcoholic. And I think that he was drinking when he was nice and that he wasn't drinking when he wasn't nice.
Allegedly.
It was hot that day we met him and he was really nice. It was so hot.
You have a lot of reason to be an asshole at that show. But.
Yeah, and it was really, really hot in there and it was really slow.
You know, old people love it really hot, though. You notice that? Like, if you go in, like.
That's true, they do.
Elderly people's homes or nursing homes and shit, and it's always hotter than hell in
there. It is hotter than hell.
Because their circulation blows when you get that old.
They're always cold. Let's see. Amber Miller Wallace says, have you heard rumors on the new It remake? Wondered if it was true or just a rumor.
I don't know.
We haven't heard anything about it. I'm sorry, Amber.
Also,
it's going to suck, though. I'd probably guarantee you that.
I don't think anybody can do better than Tim Curry.
Mm-mm.
Or John Boy.
Yeah, but they'll get Jackie Earl Haley to be Pennywise. Okay. But it'll all work out.
Hey, kids.
They all float down here.
Also, really geeky, but a question. What is your favorite obscure movie posters? Not talking about the well-known horror, but the odd ones. She says, mine would have to be Bloodbath or Macumba Love or Snuff.
Ooh, Macumba Love. Well, I've actually got a really rare variant to a poster a lot of people may not have seen. If you go on my Facebook page, you can check it out. It's actually the poster right behind you. It's the Slumber Party Massacre one sheet with Ernest P. Worrell in it. That was before they took him out of the movie.
Yeah, he had a big part in that.
He was one of the girls in it. He was a transvestite.
He's gangbanger number 2.
Yeah.
We got one, though, or actually Jess bought me one that I really thought was awesome. I think that the guys over at Grindhouse Cinema must have designed it or had somebody design it, but it was the one sheet they put out for the re-release of Gone in the Way of the Pope.
Gone with the Pope.
Gone with the Pope, yeah. Gone the Way of the Pope.
Gone the Way of the Flesh.
Yeah.
That's where you're getting it confused with. I always liked Don't Go in the Woods, the one sheet for...
Don't go in the woods.
That one, and I always like the Forest, the cover for Forest.
Yeah.
Whether or not Rabbit you like the movie or not, the Forest one sheet's fucking killer.
But nobody likes that movie. I've noticed that. Like, nobody likes that movie.
I'm talking about the poster.
Or Don't Go in the Woods. Everybody hates those movies, and I don't know why.
I don't give a shit if they hate them or not. The posters are killer. Nobody can deny that.
Can't deny how awesome they are. Shit on you.
She says, thanks, guys. Best thing about Thursdays, you guys.
Friday, you mean?
Fuck yeah!
Well, she might watch it on the different day. Or listen to it on a different day.
Oh. Well, we appreciate Amber, don't we?
I think that's it. Good Lord.
That's a lot of questions.
That was.
I'm tired as hell now.
So, we're going to take a break. We'll actually have some announcements and some Blu-ray reviews. Jess is going to be reviewing Hereafter by herself.
With no feedback. Neither one of us is going to be her. That would be the best review ever.
An hour-long bitch fest.
I doubt that. You'd be like, I don't know what to say.
You're being awfully mean.
But we will be back after this break here on DeadBit.com.
Dracula has risen from the grave.
Boy, does he give a hickey.
Howdy, everybody.
Hello.
And welcome back. Long-ass call-in portion, or, well, no call-ins. Let's see, the mailbag. And we got reviews to get to a little bit later on, but we do have some announcements we need to make, Uncle Bill.
Mm-hmm. You talking about the announcement?
Well, we can lead our way up to that. I got a couple things I can mention.
All
right. Dead Pit on the Road, Season 3, is out there available to buy. Buy it now. As quick as you can. There's a lot of... Disc 2 features a ton of stuff that nobody's ever seen before. So you got to get it if you're a Dead Pit fan. And also, we would probably try to put up... I think there's two commentaries that we've done that haven't been up for sale yet. And we'll probably put those up.
It would
be Burial Ground...
Knights of Terror.
And Silent Night, Deadly Night 2.
Wow.
Ooh.
Holla back, y'all. Holla back, y'all.
Holla. So we'll probably put those up. Next week, of course, is May of the Dead again. And Friday the 13th, which is never, we've never done a Friday the 13th in May before, I don't think.
It's weird. I'm conflicted about all this.
Yeah, we're trying, like I've talked to a few people related to the Friday the 13th series. We're trying to get somebody that would be interesting. We'll just have to wait and see if we can do that. If not, we'll just do a big retrospective again with Jess's opinion.
Woo!
Because mine is the only one that matters.
Well, you think it is.
So, well, I guess the other big announcement, I'm going to let Jess tell everybody.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to say?
Well, okay. We can lead up. We can talk about this because we haven't... I guess you guys have been planning this, and the Fright Night Film Fest is coming up. And there's a lot of stuff going on at Fright Night Film Fest. A lot of guests and all that. And you guys actually have a big announcement to make, too, about Fright Night Film Fest.
So... at the Fright Night Film Fest in Louisville, Kentucky, the one that's coming up, the big one with John Carpenter and all that, Jess and I have decided that there's no better place to do this at, and we're going to have the wedding ceremony complete with like a horror-themed atmosphere and at the convention and the whole nine yards. There's going to be a cake, a lovely wedding cake and all
cake.
That. But yeah, that's going to be our plan. So it's kind of a big deal. We're committing to the rest of our lives together.
Horror style.
Your lives are over. Now, I'm actually really excited about this. We're going to have the bachelor party the night before. There's going to be a lot of naked big titted strippers running around. And Jess isn't invited to that.
Nope.
And then there's the one that I'm going to.
Which one are you going to?
He's going to the one with the porn stars in it that lick his ass.
Oh my God.
So that'll be
interesting. What kind of party am I going to have?
You can have a bachelorette party.
I'll have a baby shower.
Yeah, you can have the party where you just lay in a bed because that's all you saw those.
I'm pretty sure they're not real, but like I've always wondered, like, have you ever seen those bachelorette party like videos that are like shot on camcorder, but they're kind of like porns, where the fucking male strippers like squirt like whipped cream on their dick and shit?
No, I've never seen that.
Yeah,
they squirt it on there and then somebody licks it off or something. God damn, that's hardcore.
Yeah, the females in the bachelorette party do that.
Yep.
Do you want that?
That's what happens.
The black stripper.
Well, you guys get big titties in your face, and we need to do something. We need to have something.
The black stripper, when they use, they can use one entire can on their dick. It's like, shit, give me some more of that shit.
They cut up a couple bananas, put them on there.
Some cherries
on top.
Pound
the cherries.
Some crushed pineapples and some nuts.
Yeah, nuts.
But anyway, the Dead Pit Wedding. It's going to be at Fright Night Film Fest.
It is between
Jess Cole and Uncle Bill.
It's the merger of us.
So it's going to be some kind of horror theme to it. We just haven't figured that part out yet.
You're the horror part.
Yeah, I'm the scary part. Of course.
No, we have to figure out more of the specifics. Like, we don't know exactly if it's going to be a special event there, if people are just going to be able to come to it, how it's going to be set up, what's going to be like the theme exactly or anything like that. I guess that's up to whoever else.
Yeah.
But the only thing we know is that we're getting free shit, and that's the only thing we care about.
Yeah, we're definitely.
Oh, that is not the only thing that we care about. No, stop that.
No, I mean about the actual wedding ceremony. Of course, we care about each other. Otherwise, we'll be doing this shit.
Aww.
Oh, they care about each other, folks. So anyway, let's get on to the fucking movie reviews. Blu-ray Death, which one you want to talk about first over here? Leave her alone.
She's got to cheer up, though.
What are you talking about?
It's getting uber depressing.
She's just fucking OCD, buddy. She's got to be doing something with her hands at all times.
My hands are here. What am I doing?
I need to keep busy.
Well, we're doing the show, so you stay focused.
I am focused. Okay. I'm very focused.
Let's let Jess, though, go ahead and start with the Hereafter with Matt Damon.
That movie was really not good.
Give us your opinions about it, Jess. Explain the story and give some insight into it.
It was really depressing. A bunch of sad shit happened to a bunch of people.
God.
It was really sad. Sat there and like some shit happened, like when these people would die.
Some sad shit would happen when these people would die. Well,
first of all, I didn't even know it was directed by
Clint Eastwood. Okay. So, give a little bit of backstory on this movie, though. I don't even remember this movie coming out in theaters.
I don't think it did it?
I think it did. It had to. But, I mean, it must have been one of those real limited releases that didn't stay out for long. Because, like, I remember when I got the press release for this, I was like, what the fuck is this? I never heard of it before. Evidently, it did really, really poorly at the box office.
Wonder why.
Look, we need to give the actual opinion of the movie here in a little bit. Okay, we're going to talk about the movie. The plot itself is really weird because it follows like three or four different storylines throughout the whole movie. And it all, you know how they go. They always sort of come together at the end. One of the plots revolves around these two kids who are brothers who are basically taking care of their mother who's a drunk, Jessica. And
I quit drinking.
Well, but here in a few months you'll be back in the saddle again. But one of them is killed in an accident, and the other kid is trying to find peace somehow. I guess that's the best way to go about it.
Yeah, it's weird because the first story is like Cecilia de France from High Tension. This kid on High Tension is swept under like a typhoon and she almost dies. And then the other story is about a London kid who's, I guess it's his brother, his twin brother or his brother, I don't remember which, but I think they're twins. One of them dies and what was the other story? Matt Damon.
Yeah, where he's, an ex-psychic, I guess, is trying to find like a regular existence.
Trying to find love.
Yeah.
And then
he freaked out Ron Howard's daughter, baby.
Yeah, who Jess cannot stand. I found out that Jess has an incredible hatred for Bryce Dallas Howard.
I don't know. I liked her in this movie.
Thoughts?
Well, she drives me nuts. She did look really pretty in this movie, though, but still, she drove me nuts because she can't act.
She's not the best, but she's not that bad.
She's kind of stiff, but it's an exploration of how different people react to death. In like different circumstances. That's the only thing I could figure out about the movie. But for God's sake, the biggest problem with it is that you're sitting there and it's like you're waiting for it to go somewhere for like an hour and 45 minutes and it's just continuing the story. It just like keeps going and going and going.
Yeah. I guess the big thing is like the movie, I think it's watchable throughout the whole movie. I mean, I wasn't bored through it or anything. But it's like, it doesn't have that payoff at the end, or there's nothing that really...
It doesn't really have anything interesting going on in it, I don't think. The story about the kids is probably my favorite story, but it's... All the different stories are kind of interwoven into the movie, and they skips from one to the other one to the other one, and you're just constantly kind of waiting for something to happen. It goes on so long, you forget about the other fucking stories, even. You're just like, oh, yeah.
Well, and you're wondering, like... I was wondering throughout it, too, because I'd never seen her in anything else. And I actually have an autographed photo right up there, one of the coolest things I got back of the day through the mail. Cecile de France hasn't, like, I think this is the only, she did one other movie in the U.S., which came out right around the time of High Tension, which, fuck, I can't remember it now. But, like, I'm wondering, how in the hell did she get contacted to be in this fucking movie? Because I haven't seen her in anything.
I don't know.
She just does stuff in France, usually.
You can't imagine that Clint Eastwood watched High Tension. That's what I was sitting there thinking. Like, yeah. I can't imagine he actually saw that movie and was like, oh, she's good. But overall, I'm not really sure what this movie's trying to do, but I know that whatever it is it was trying to do, it kind of failed. And it's, like I was telling Jess, I think that they should really have showed this movie to people who... or like clinically depressed, where you're just like, my God, like imagine the worst possible things that can happen to people and everything that's in that you could think of happens in this movie. Mm. It's just one horrible atrocity after another.
Yeah, I didn't think it was too bad. But yeah, I mean, it didn't, I didn't think it really it seems like, well, it was better than his movie Invictus. Have you seen that?
No, I've never seen it.
God damn, that's awful. I could, like that's one of those movies you could just, I could fall asleep on, you know? But I liked it better than that. But yeah, it's definitely not on a level of like some of the other stuff that Eastwood directed, like Mystic River. Mystic River is one of my favorites that he ever. That was just he was primarily just the director in it. Yeah, you know?
I mean the man has made Gran Torino and Million Dollar Baby and Unforgiven. This is just nowhere near the quality of any of those films.
True, but the thing is. Like I was saying, is like he's doing more movies where he's not the star in it, you know, and he's just directing it.
Yeah.
So, but I think Mystic River is probably the best one that he's done like that.
So, just for what kind of, what would you say about it overall?
I didn't like it.
Well, at least she's honest, mm-hmm. Uncle Bill. So, but the Blu-ray, I gotta say, like, there was, like, some scenes in that Blu-ray that were fucking awesome. Like, the typhoon sequence in, wherever they're at, where Cecile de France and her husband almost get killed.
Mm-hmm.
That was great.
It was good.
That looked insane.
I like the idea, though, of, the idea behind Matt Damon's character, that he's this psychic that doesn't want to do it anymore and all this stuff because it ruined all of his relationships, but I just fucking can't stand to watch Matt Damon. He's so boring as a fucking actor. You just can't, I cannot get anything out of him. Like, when he's in a film, I don't care what it is. It could be one of those Bourne Identity movies. I still think it's boring as hell.
Yeah, I don't like Bourne Identities or whatever.
I think they're making another Bourne
movie. Yeah, but he's not in it.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Yeah, I don't really like Matt Damon much of anything, really. I think he was in Talented Mr. Ripley. That's probably the one that I kind of like more than any of them.
I didn't like that one either. The only thing I remember about that movie is that one guy got whacked in the head with a...
I kind of liked that.
He likes people getting whacked in the head.
Yeah!
Let's see here. This is a Warner Brothers flick, though, and this Blu-ray has the Eastwood Factor extended version for the first time in high def.
I'm surprised Jess didn't like this, though, because it's more artsy.
It is. Yeah, it's much more like a visual...
Like film school students would like it and stuff.
You did.
No, I didn't.
I'll tell you this much, too, which I just now noticed this, and it makes perfect sense when you look at it. The executive producer, one of them was Steven Spielberg. Hmm. That kind of makes sense.
So anyway, that is Hereafter. It's actually out right now. And another one that just recently came out from Synapse Films. It's the uncensored director's cut of The Dawn That Dripped Blood.
Oh, no.
And it is a crash course in terror, Uncle Bill.
Yeah, and this one's the one that Synapse has been really, like, pushing because this is the version of the film that no one has ever seen. They took great care in finding a lot of the footage that wasn't in the original. It was called Pranks at one time. That wasn't in that version and intercut it into this film. And it took a long time for them to remaster and put all this stuff in, too. They've been working on this one for quite a while.
Yeah, there's always the thing that's cool about Synapse is they always give the fans the exact details on the making of the transfer. You always hear stories, like that's the big thing of them. And this one is the only known 35 millimeter answer print, which I guess is the print that they turn in to the MPAA for them to review back in the day or however they did it. And the original title of the movie was Death Dorm, I think. And that actually has the title on the, I don't know if you noticed that, on the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
It doesn't say Dorm That Dripped Blood, it says Death Dorm. So, they spent a lot of time and money going back and cleaning that print up to make it look as good as possible. And as good a job as they did, it's still like, I don't even know if a Blu-ray, other than the fact to say, oh, it's cool, it's on Blu-ray, really benefits from what they had with this transfer, in just my opinion.
Well, I've actually got the movie Pranks on a DVD that I've had for a long-ass time. It was on one of those multi-pack DVDs. So you can't watch it. You can't even watch it. It's so fucking dark and, like, grainy, you don't even know what's going on in the film. So the fact that they were able to put this out, and the transfer looks like either a low, like, DVD transfer or, like, a high VHS transfer, the fact they were able to even get it to that point is pretty much amazing considering
what it was. If you watch the movie, you can tell it's, like, almost a no-budget film when it came out.
Right, yeah.
And this is one of the many movies that in the early 80s, like, what year did this come out? Like, 81? It just really got lost in the shuffle with all the other slasher movies that were coming out around that time. Like, the years from, like, 1980 to about 84, there's probably, like, 700, 800 slasher films that came out in that amount of time, which is insane.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is really a whole lot like, you know, the ones like Prom Night and, what's some more? There's April Fool's Day. And Friday the 13th, of course, just very similar to that. The story is like a college dorm after the semester. They're getting ready to tear it down, and there's like four or five left behind who are like cataloging all the stuff, and they're going to sell it or whatever, all the stuff that was in the school. And, of course, one by one, they get obliterated.
Mm-hmm.
You missed it, too. You didn't see it.
No, I was working.
You ought to be ashamed.
Well, I mean, in terms of what you really look for in a film like this, which is the death scenes and things like that, this movie's actually pretty fucking cool.
I've never actually seen Pranks, so I don't know how much of that stuff was actually in
it. And I thought about going back and watching the DVD that I got and then trying to watch this, but I just didn't have time to do it. But I don't remember a lot of the sequences in this film being as long as they were in the version that I got. But there's a lot of really cool stuff like the baseball bat scene and the car scene and stuff like that.
Yeah,
too.
I'm pretty sure the baseball bat scene, they had to be cut because he was hit with that baseball bat how many times?
Yeah.
Usually MPAA is like one time is enough, and they won't let you like show any obligatory hits.
Yeah, I get it. And the one other thing I noticed about this movie too that was kind of funny was the acting. Like, it's got some of the worst like amateur acting in it that you'll ever fucking see. Even Daphne Zuniga, who's in it, who kind of went on for a little while to have a bit of a career in mainstream films.
A D-list career.
Yeah, she was on like Melrose Place and stuff like that too. I mean, she's horrible in this as well. I
really,
guess.
Really young.
This has to be one of her first movies, yeah.
You know what, though? I mean, it's 88 minutes long. It's a fun slasher movie. You know, it's nothing that's groundbreaking. It doesn't... You know, I would hope that Synapse would get a hold of some other slasher films from the 80s. I doubt it. I doubt they will. I know fucking, I was joking with Don May about releasing Home Sweet Home. I'm positive if he had the rights to do it, he would do it, and he would give it the same sort of treatment.
Mm-hmm. Even though that movie's excruciatingly horrible, it's not anywhere near.
Yeah, but who knows? I mean, maybe there's an uncut version of that somewhere. It's got more extended death scenes.
Got more of that guy walking around that guitar.
Yeah.
Shit.
But that's the thing that's so cool about Synapse is they actually go the extra mile with any movie they release. I mean, they don't really, you know, they're not biased towards anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's something they've got a hold of and they really want to release it to the best, you know, the best it could ever look. And they did, you know, The Dorm That Dripped Blood was released in theaters as The Dorm That Dripped Blood. But I don't know the whole details behind that, what cuts were made of it. But this cut of Death Dorm, which is really what it should have been called, but I guess people wouldn't know what the hell it was if it was released as Death Dorm, has never, ever been seen before. So it's actually pretty cool. And it features quite a bit of special features on here, including audio commentary with the director, Jeffrey O'Brow, and Stephen Carpenter, both directors, actually. And interviews with composer Christopher Young, who went on to do a whole lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Hellraiser being the bigger one.
Makeup effects creator Matthew Mungle. Isolated music track. Original theatrical trailers. And actually has, check this out. I don't know if you noticed this. You can reverse the cover and you can make it. What does it mean? You can make it the Blu-ray of Pranks.
Oh, look at that.
Isn't that cool?
That's neat.
So if you don't like the Dorm That Dripped Blood title, you can reverse it, and now it's Pranks. So you can act like you have two Blu-rays.
Put that out that way. I actually like the Dorm That Dripped Blood cover better, though, because I like that design. As far as the movie goes, yeah, like you said, it's a slasher film that follows the same type of formula as a lot of the other ones, and it's just as good as the rest of them. And, I mean, what else can you say about it? I think you will never find a version that looks any better. Knowing Don May like I know him and how he does the transfers on these movies, I don't think anybody else is going to come along and fix it anymore, at least not that version of the film. Yeah. So this is the version to buy, and all of Synapse's Blu-rays are the best quality Blu-rays that I see on a consistent basis. Nobody does, at least in the cult market, like Blue Underground, Ava
Well,
Bay,
to be fair,
like
they only have like, what, two or three that are out. So we'll just have to wait and see. But I mean, you know, I'm sure of the material that was out there that it probably couldn't have looked any better than what they've got on this Blu-ray. I just think personally, like, they probably could have just released the DVD of that and it would have sufficed, you know, because like I said, they didn't have access to an original negative of and that's usually what Don May wants, or the positive, or whatever the deal is, the original source materials.
Right. We don't know. But anyway, Dorm That Dripped Blood, buy it today.
Yeah, Jeff didn't get to see it because he was working. So that is it for week one of May. Now, week two, of course, is also Friday the 13th. So, who knows what we may have planned. Only the shadow knows.
Yeah, we don't ever know anyway.
So, we will be back then, and we'll be talking Friday the 13th films and probably other zombie films and other goodness. So, until then, everybody keep it creepy, and go fuck yourself. If you don't like. Over on Dead Pit.
Dot com.